Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
The highest court in the state of Massachusetts is considering roadside sobriety tests, specifically whether the tests that police use to determine drunk driving can also prove a driver is high on marijuana. As NPR's Tovia Smith reports, with more states like Massachusetts legalizing recreational marijuana, this question is becoming more pressing.
The test has been used for decades to convict drunk drivers.
Go ahead and step right here in front of my car, please.
Just like in this stop recorded by police in Tennessee, a driver has to stand on one leg, walk a straight line, and recite the alphabet. The officer can then testify in court how the driver did to make the case for DUI. But defense lawyers argue science has yet to prove that flunking the test really means a person is high. So as attorney Rebecca Jacobstein argued to Massachusetts High Court, the test shouldn't be allowed in evidence.
If there's reliable science gets to come in. It's just that unreliable science does not.
Your Honor, that is clearly wrong.
Attorney Michelle King for the prosecutors argued that rapidly advancing science does now prove field tests' reliability.
Three investigations have come to light, and those are the most important for your honors to look at this point.
What makes the stakes so high here is that police do not yet have reliable roadside toxicology tests to say for sure if someone's too high to drive, the way a breathalyzer or blood test can show if someone's too drunk.
It's complicated. Alcohol is a breeze in comparison.
Margaret Haney is a professor of neurobiology at the Columbia University Medical Center. Because marijuana is fat-soluble, traces of its main ingredient, THC, can show up in blood, for example, long after a person is sobered up.
That just tells you that somebody smoked, but you don't know if they smoked, you know, an hour before, or if they smoked a week before or 2 weeks before.
It used to be that police could always fall back on arresting a driver for possession. But with pot now legal, officers worry they'll be faced with more stoned drivers and fewer ways to stop them.
It couldn't be at a worse time. It's really going to cause a problem out on the street.
John Carmichael is police chief in Walpole, Massachusetts.
I mean, police officers know, you know, when there's something off. It's usually quite obvious. So if they take away the ability to do a field sobriety test, I don't know what the police officer on the street is supposed to do.
As studies continue on standard field sobriety tests, efforts are also underway to design new ones to better weed out drivers high on weed.
So you can see it's a real app there.
University of Massachusetts psychology professor Michael Milburn has invented an iPad test he calls Druid that specifically measures symptoms of marijuana intoxication, like slow reaction time, misperception of time passing, and the inability to multitask.
So this says when the circle flashes on the screen, hit the screen where you saw the circle appear. If the square appears, hit the white oval that's going to be on the top of the screen.
Okay. God help me.
It is not meant to be easy.
Right, because I figure someone who's stoned is going to go, all right, what? Was it the circle or the square? You know?
This is not your grandfather's old count backwards from 10.
Yeah, well, if you're going to be driving a car, you should be able to perform at a fairly high level.
Next, you have to balance on one foot while you hold the iPad in one hand.
Oh, my God.
Where it records your every wobble.
I'm holding my microphone, too. Do I get extra points for that?
After four different tests, instead of a police officer's subjective judgment of how you did, the iPad calculates a total score that could be used like the .08 legal limit for alcohol.
So I have?
Your impairment score was 48, which we estimate was equivalent to a blood alcohol of .06. So you are not legally drunk.
But almost.
Well, you were getting up there. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But a cop would not say, I'm taking you in, based on what you just did.
Milburn says research is just beginning on the reliability of his app. Experts say it won't be long before science validates a whole new generation of impairment tests. But they say they'll only stand up to court challenges when used in conjunction with new and better biological tests that can also prove that the person who was impaired recently used marijuana. Tovia Smith, NPR News, Boston.
For a cop, as good as I, a book of guy for drinking crooked eye, a resist, a pit and pie, you think I won't, but why wouldn't I? I'm a cop.
We begin with a story that's dominating our local news. Nearly 3 years ago, a schizophrenic young black man was killed during a nighttime clash with police officers in South Los Angeles. Yesterday, the district attorney announced that they will not bring criminal charges against the two officers that shot him, saying he posed an immediate threat to their safety. The young man was Ezell Ford. The district attorney is Jackie Lacey, and she joins me now. Thank you for making time this morning.
Good morning, Mr. Martinez. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Now, let's, if we can, start with a look at the timeline. Now, Ford was shot August of 2014. The police commission in 2015 determined that one of the officers violated LAPD rules in shooting Ford. And yesterday you made the decision not to file charges against either of the officers. Why did you choose not to do that?
Well, we took a long look. Our timeline is the police brought us the case in May of 2015. Then we discovered there was a federal civil case. And so we intervened in January of 2016 in that case to get the transcripts of all the witnesses' testimonies, and those transcripts weren't released to us until June of 2016. So we did a thorough review, and basically what was convincing to our lawyers was the physical evidence in this case supported the conclusion that Mr. Ford and Officer Wampler were struggling for possession of his service weapon at the time of the shooting. And that, for us, there was a lot of physical evidence, including DNA, piece, you know, a magazine from the gun on the ground, as well as injuries to both Ford and Mr. Ford and Officer Wampler that indicated that this was a struggle, that it was a life and death struggle.
How does that square with what the police commission ruled?
You know, the police commission looked at something different, and the police commission looked at the tactics used by the officer. Namely, they seemed to focus in on the stop, whether the stop itself had probable cause or was justified, or if it could have been done a different way. And the standard for their level of proof or whatever is different. It's lower than ours. With us, my goal was to look at, should I charge Wampler and Vegas with committing an unlawful homicide? Did they break the law in what they did? And could I prove, if I felt that way, could I prove beyond a reasonable doubt that they were guilty of murder, essentially? And the physical evidence supported so strongly a self-defense claim in this matter that we felt we could not overcome that and decided to reject the case for filing of any criminal charges.
So what, when it comes to what the police commission does, though, how much of that goes into what you do? Because you mentioned the bar is different.
Right. Actually, it doesn't. We get our evidence independent of the police commission, and we do not rely on the police commission findings in order to come to our conclusions. We included the police commission transcripts or information from police commission transcripts in our officer-involved shooting report, which is online. It's a 28-page report, because we wanted the public to understand what we had to deal with and what the evidence, the state of the evidence was. But in essence, we looked at witnesses' statements. We did our own interviewing, as well as we looked at transcripts from the federal case.
What physical evidence did you look at to make this decision?
In our report, you will see photographs of, for instance, the condition of the physical condition of Officer Wampler's hand and wrist, as well as you'll see diagrams taken from the autopsy of Mr. Ford. We also had Officer Wampler's holster tested. And Mr. Ford's DNA was on there. We looked at the location of the magazine on the ground, as well as there was an independent witness who said that they heard the officer say, "Let go of the gun, let go of the gun." And so those things were very persuasive to us in terms of this was a struggle over that gun.
Speaking with Jackie Lacey, L.A. District Attorney, on the decision not to file charges, criminal charges, against the officers involved in the Ezell Ford shooting. Your office and the LAPD have a very mutually reliant relationship. The LAPD investigates for your office. They also serve as advisors during trials. It's a relationship that the police commission does not have. What would you say to people who might infer that because of this relationship, it's harder for you to press charges against police officers?
Well, I would say look at the cases that we have brought. We currently have two off-duty murder cases against two officers. We are prosecuting a couple of officers for sexual assault. We have convicted officers of off-duty homicides in the past. We do maintain our independence. While it's correct, on the regular cases, we do have a relationship. We rely on their investigation. But we're very independent. We have our own mission, our own views. And we get about 90 of these cases a year, 90 officer-involved shootings a year. They don't all end into fatalities. But we have our own investigative unit. I neglected to mention that. We have the Bureau of Investigations, which has 270 officers that are sworn in-house. So we do maintain our independence. It's hard, obviously, looking from the outside to see it, but there is a healthy tension between our agencies, and we don't always agree.
Can you understand when someone looks at the numbers and sees an overwhelming amount of officers not being charged for a lot of things that they would say, "Wait, that can't be right. That doesn't seem to make sense."
Sure, I can understand it, and. It's healthy to have this kind of criticism and questioning, but you need to know the law. And the law in this area is a case called Graham versus Connor, which is detailed in our report. And Graham versus Connor basically gives police officers who are empowered to carry guns and enforce the law wide latitude on, especially when they're in peril, when they believe that their life is in danger. And if the officer honestly and reasonably believes that their life is in danger, they're entitled to defend themselves.
Even if they create the situation themselves?
Well, in this situation, I think that's an arguable point. You know, in other words, what you're talking about is the stop. No matter if the stop is legal or not, remember, in this case, They stopped Mr. Ford, and then Mr. Ford, it is alleged, turned around and grabbed one of the officers around the waist, and they both fell to the ground, and Mr. Ford was on top of him. And so that part, you know, obviously is certainly debatable, but we feel that in this set of circumstances that the officer then doesn't have to lay there and be killed because the stop is questionable. He has a right to defend himself.
This shooting happened in South Los Angeles, and it's a community that has a fraught history with police. What's your message to South Los Angeles today?
You know, my message is that obviously Ezell Ford is a 25-year-old young man who, and it's tragic that that his life ended in this way. And what my message is that these cases, notwithstanding that these cases are extremely challenging, and no one wins from this particular decision. No one should be celebrating or be happy about what happened here. But the law of the land is that if an officer reasonably believes that his life is in danger, he's entitled to defend himself. And that right now is the status of the law, and that's what the DA's office does. Is we look carefully at the facts. We left no stone unturned, looked at every piece of evidence we could, talked to everyone who would talk to us, and did the absolute best we could. And given that set of facts and the state of the law, that's the decision.
Jackie Lacey is the Los Angeles District Attorney. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Mama, is Master going to sell us tomorrow? Yes, yes, yes. Mama, is Master going to sell us tomorrow? Yes, yes. Yes.
University of Texas historian Dinah Ramey Barry has spent the last decade studying the economic forces that have defined black and white relations in the United States. Her book, The Price for Their Pound of Flesh, The Value of the Enslaved from Womb to Grave in the Building of a Nation, is out today. Professor Barry joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you.
How hard was this to unpack in a way that's relevant today without just looking at, accounting sheets and old, slave auction documents that you can see in museums today?
One of the things that I wanted to do was try to make sure that enslaved people's voices were central to the conversation. And so as I was using plantation records and ledgers and books of those nature, I had to find ways to weave in what enslaved people said or thought or how they reacted to those very same scenes that other people were reporting.
So would enslaved people take pride in having a higher price or a lower price?
Actually, I was surprised, but no, that wasn't the case. They didn't really care about their market values. What they cared about was who they were sold to or where they were going or if a relative had already been sold away from them. They wanted to be purchased by a certain person so they could get closer to that family member. But they didn't really complain or worry about their high or low values. They felt like they had other values, a different set of values that were more important to them. And that is what I call their soul values.
What in this part of American history has really not been told and that you're bringing to light for the first time? And how does it inform what's going on today in America, do you think?
The first is that most people don't realize that enslaved people were sold before they were born. They were also sold after they died. And I think that's a piece of this story that has not really been talked about that much in very many history books. And to understand that valuation occurred before, anticipating women's fertility, anticipating the health of their unborn children, and accounting for that in the records, and then also this sort of illegal clandestine market of cadavers that were sold to medical schools for anatomical research.
When you think about all of those features and the value of the unborn, how would a woman be evaluated in her fertility? I mean, would it literally be said, well, she'll probably have this many kids? Was it known who she would have children with, those kinds of things?
Yeah, sometimes planters deliberately forced or selected particular people to partner up. And I look at this as a form of non-consensual intercourse. But they might have handpicked someone who was a strong worker, who had physical capabilities that maybe other enslaved people didn't express. And they would force those two to be together. They also would look at women to see if they had already had children, if those children were doing well, if they were working well. And if a woman had given birth to a number of children and they survived to age 5, they would kind of look at her as someone that they could look to as a breeding woman. And then that term, in that day, they would use the term breeding wench.
Did you imagine, as you were doing your research, how you would have responded to some of the conditions that the enslaved people had to endure?
It's easy for us, today to look back and think, well, this is what I would have done, or this is how I would have escaped, or this is how I would have subverted the institution. But I think in that moment, it's just hard for us to really truly imagine, because there's so many other circumstances that I think are unimaginable to our lives today.
One of the things that's very compelling about this book, and you describe it as a kind of a principle that you used in developing this history is that you wanted to use names whenever you could. You couldn't always make them characters because you didn't know that much about them, but you wanted to hold on to that name. Can you just repeat some of the names that you've brought to life in this book, just so that we can hear in the way that you hear it, how that name signifies them as people as opposed to bodies? Because I think that's the sacredness here that you've tried to bring to light.
Yeah. These are names that were not necessarily in history books up until recently. So there's Ponto, you know, a 40-year-old man who fights back at the auction block and argues with the auctioneer about how healthy he is. And he tells his audience that they're lying, that the auctioneer is lying, that he's not as healthy as they say he is. There's Celia, a slave who we know a little bit about from her court testimony, but she fought the sexual abuse from her owner. She had given birth to two children from him, and she finally fought back at some point, and she killed him. We also have Isaac, and Isaac is probably my favorite person in the entire manuscript. He was being executed for leading a revolution or trying to lead a rebellion. And while he was on the gallows and they were about to hang him, he jumped to his own death. And I describe that as him expressing his soul value. Rather than let somebody pull the latch, he chose to jump on his own terms.
Dinah Ramey Barry is the author of The Price for Their Pound of Flesh, The Value of the Enslaved from Womb to Grave in the Building of a Nation. She's a professor of history at the University of Texas at Austin. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Our Lives Matter, a review. Rob G. Kelly's new work of poetry screams from its cover, Our Lives Matter. In an era of the black youth movement, often termed Black Lives Matter by the corporate press, and in fact formerly named the Movement for Black Lives, this work seems especially written for them, for many of the motivating factors that drove black youth into the streets with fevered protest and the often fragile demonstrations fraught with danger. Here I want to recall the Ferguson example, where men, women, and children were confronting cops armed with weapons of war. They echo here with the names of Mike Brown, Rekia Boyd, Freddie Gray, and are the stuff and meat of poems, hymns to the dead. Kelly's poems are prayers written on paper and cast into the winds of fate like kites or chicks tossed from the steel nest of prison. He shares his pain, his dreams, his visions, and his hopes in these poems, which are as interesting as they are inventive. Imagine how he teases and caresses words in a poem with the surprising title, Tonight I Date the Rain. Kelly is a sober young man who has spent enough time in the bowels of prison to feel and express not just his longing, but his highest, most sacred hopes, a way of living for Africans in America. He often uses the term Nubians, without the ever-present sense of dread. Divided into three sections, he creates a triangle of lust, righteous indignation, and the tenderest of loves. He's smart enough and savvy enough to respect and to elevate his elders who have inspired him, like Gwendolyn Brooks and Sonia Sanchez. If you enjoy reading poetry, Our Lives Matter may be the next book for you to buy and feed upon to enrich and nourish the soul. If you want the book, it's available from smashwords.com. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu Jamal.
5, 4, 3.
She's pure alligator. Pure white.
2.
Albinos that do make it to reproductive age can't find a mate because they look funny.
1.
Albino affairs.
Poe, an albino alligator with skin so bright she truly lives up to her name. The 7.5-foot-long, 105-pound alligator is no slouch, and her pink eyes make it hard to see where she is looking. The incredible images show Pearl, the resident albino alligator at Gatorland in Orlando. Pearl is 10 years old, said a spokesperson for the park. She arrived at Gatorland when she was 3 years old. Pearl is an albino alligator, due to the complete absence of pigmentation, which gives her white skin and pink eyes. Visitors to the park like to come and see a rare albino alligator like Pearl. The 100-acre theme park, which has been open since 1949, is also home to leucistic alligators, which are alligators that have dark eyes but also lack pigmentation in their skin. Only around 15 in 5 million alligators are born with this genetic default. Sadly, leucistic alligators and crocodiles are highly desirable when it comes to making expensive handbags. The park attempts to combat their slaughter by buying and rescuing alligators from trappers that would kill them for their meat and skin. Other white gators that have been residents at Gatorland over the years include Albino Whitey, an alligator that toured Europe 9 years ago, and Bia Blan, who was found deep in a Louisiana swamp. Beano, another albino breed, famously had to receive acupuncture treatment at his home in Brazil's São Paulo Aquarium, after suffering back and leg problems. I came as Harry and topped up with the truth to sojourn up. Other times, I had to come as Nat Turner. They tried to burn me, lynch me, and starve me. So I had to come back as Marcus Garvey. But countless millions of black men and women who have died in America, those who have died in the West Indies, and those who have died in Africa, to aid you in the fight for liberty, freedom, and life. Marcus Garvey, the Jamaican-born black empowerment leader, died in 1940. But most civil rights experts will still tell you this. Before Martin Luther King Jr., before Malcolm X, before Nelson Mandela, there was Marcus Garvey.
Marcus Garvey was before his time.
Nyella Harrison is a Jamaican-American attorney in Miami and president-elect of the Caribbean Bar Association, which is based in Miami.
He was speaking about things that had never been spoken about before when we're talking about self-determination and the advancement of black and colored people.
So Harrison is disappointed that Barack Obama, the first black U.S. president, didn't grant Garvey a posthumous pardon before leaving office last week. Garvey was convicted in the U.S. in 1923 for mail fraud. His sentence was commuted in 1927, but he was deported back to Jamaica. Since then, supporters have urged his exoneration because they say his trial was racially motivated. FBI documents acknowledge as much.
It was a political witch hunt with absolutely no evidence.
Dr. Julius Garvey is Marcus Garvey's son. He's a vascular surgeon on Long Island, New York.
He's still being stained in the United States, so it's important to clear that from his name. It's a slur that needs to be removed.
We've gotten significant support in the United States.
This month, Julius Garvey donated his father's Jamaican National Hero Medal to a museum in Kingston. Jamaica chose Marcus Garvey as its first national hero after the country won independence from Britain in 1962. Marcus Garvey wasn't the first black civil rights leader, but he was arguably the first to focus on black pride and self-reliance. The organizations he founded in the early 20th century crusaded for everything from black entrepreneurship to the Pan-African struggle against colonial rule. After World War I, he emigrated to New York and founded the Black Star Shipping Line to help promote black business in the U.S. and abroad.
He's a worldwide figure. He was dealing with the problems of African people on the continent and in the diaspora.
Advocates say a pardon for Marcus Garvey would raise his profile among civil rights icons, and that could give the civil rights movement a boost today at a moment when Donald Trump's presidency makes its future feel uncertain.
This is definitely the appropriate time, because all of the freedom movements that took place in the United States and in the Caribbean and in Africa owe their genesis to Marcus Garvey. Martin Luther King said Marcus Garvey was the first that mobilized millions of African Americans.
So if all that's true, why didn't Obama pardon him? A number of U.S. senators and congressmen lobbied for it, as did Jamaican prime ministers. Thousands of people signed petitions for it.
I don't know. I can't get into his mind.
Obama didn't give a reason. He did issue one of the lowest numbers of pardons of any president. But there may have been other factors. Marcus Garvey was controversial. He was often accused of promoting racial separation, and he also made some anti-Semitic remarks. Nyella Harrison of the Caribbean Bar Association feels something else played a role in Obama's decision. Outside Caribbean enclaves like Miami's, Marcus Garvey is far removed from the modern American consciousness, so pardoning him just wasn't that politically urgent.
It could be that President Obama simply doesn't see a need for it. But I grew up in a Rastafarian Jamaican household, so Marcus Garvey was always part of what I learned as a child. I mean, he was a part of what shaped the United States' civil rights.
So advocates say they'll keep working to clear Marcus Garvey's name. A documentary of his life and work began production last month.
There's an old African proverb about the tale of the hunt. The hunter's always telling the story, and I've said now it's time for the lion to tell the story.
Jamaican-American filmmaker Roy Anderson of New Jersey is directing the documentary. Anderson is a descendant of the leaders of a Jamaican slave revolt known as Maroons, and he, too, is disappointed by Obama's decision.
Without Marcus Garvey, there may not have been a Barack Obama.
But that's now left for presidents after Obama to decide. I'm Tim Padgett in Miami. You can read more of our Latin America coverage at WLRN.org.
Hitler had the supreme fascist state. And what was he worried about in Europe and in Germany? He was worried about white genetic annihilation. What is everybody in Europe worried about now? Why genetic annihilation? All these people from Syria coming up in here.
Populist movements had a good 2016. First, the Brexit vote, then Donald Trump's victory. 2017 could bring more of the same. There will be big elections in the Netherlands, France, and Germany. This week on the show, we're going to hear from three leaders of European populist movements. And we begin today with an anti-immigrant politician who is leading the polls in the Netherlands. Lauren Freyer traveled to The Hague to meet the man some call the Dutch Donald Trump.
This was the scene at a political rally nearly 3 years ago when Geert Wilders, a member of the Dutch parliament and head of the Freedom Party, asked supporters.
In deze stad en in Nederland. Meer of minder Marokkanen.
In the Netherlands, do you want more or fewer Moroccans? Fewer, the crowd chants.
Well, for me, I saw that and it really hit me emotionally.
Mustafa Hilali is a lieutenant colonel in the Dutch army and happens to be of Moroccan descent. He's one of more than 5,000 people who sued Wilders and won. The politician was convicted late last year of inciting discrimination against Moroccans. But he got no punishment. In fact, Geert Wilders surged in the polls.
This reputation, this image that we always have of ourselves as a very tolerant and moderate and acceptant country is skin deep. His rise shows that there are a lot of people out there who actually have very different ideas about how the Netherlands should be.
Over tea at their home, Hilali and his native Dutch wife, Linda van Noord, recount how they wanted to give their baby a Moroccan name, but worried the boy would face a lifetime of discrimination. Van Noord was also a plaintiff in the Wilders lawsuit, but she says she understands why many other Dutch people support him.
Because the area where my grandparents lived their whole life, it changed radically. You know, suddenly there's this huge mosque now right in front of your home. They're not racist. They're coping with what to them is an extreme change.
The Netherlands went from virtually zero to about 10% immigrant in just a few decades. Geert Wilders promises to reverse that and return the Netherlands to its white Christian roots. But what makes him different from other far-right politicians is that he's for gay rights, legal drugs, women's lib. What appeals to many voters here is that Wilders says he wants to protect those liberal Dutch values from an enemy that he says is Islam.
A lot of people from Islamic background don't care a bit about our values, our culture, our identity, our freedom, or the rights of women not to be harassed.
Wilders refuses most interviews. He prefers to tweet instead. But I managed to catch him in the hallway of the Dutch parliament. It was just after the ISIS attack on a Christmas market in Berlin, and Wilders was irate. He'd just tweeted a photoshopped picture of German Chancellor Angela Merkel with blood on her hands.
We should hold Mrs. Merkel accountable. We should hold the Dutch Prime Minister accountable. They are all of the same bunch, irresponsible, cowardly, and we have to change our societies and to fight back and defend our values and our people. And that's the only way that we can save our liberty.
He wants to ban the Quran, shut down mosques, and pull Holland out of the European Union. He's an isolationist. He wants to cut all foreign aid. And just like the Arab Spring a few years ago, Wilders says a wave of populist anger is now sweeping the West, and he's proud to be one of its leaders.
I'm a patriot. I believe there is a patriotic spring going on in the world today, in the Western world. Donald Trump did that job in America, and I hope that here in Europe we will see a patriotic spring, both in Holland, but also in Germany, in France, in many other countries where parties like mine are getting stronger every day.
His anti-Muslim stance has earned him death threats. When I interviewed him, I had to squeeze my microphone between beefy bodyguards. Such security became common for Dutch critics of Islam 12 years ago after a local filmmaker, Theo van Gogh, was murdered in the street by a Muslim extremist. Van Gogh had made a movie criticizing Islam. Many Dutch who might not agree with Wilders still vehemently support his freedom of speech and think the discrimination case against him was ridiculous. One of them is Gijs van de Westerlaken, a colleague of the late filmmaker van Gogh.
I think the trial against him was completely wrong. They shouldn't have done this. If anybody has a right on free speech, it's him. On the other hand, yes, well, he's a politician. He exaggerates.
Wilders was nevertheless named Politician of the Year for 2016. He's poised to win the most votes in the Dutch election in March, though rival parties are not likely to back him to be prime minister. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Freyer in The Hague.
The list of things to do in Seattle is long.
A man was shot in the middle of a protest at the University of Washington Friday night. He's in critical condition at Harborview. KUOW's John Ryan reports.
Hundreds of people gathered on the campus to either attend or protest a speech by Milo Yiannopoulos. He's an editor with the white nationalist-associated website Breitbart. Alex Frankie is a UW senior and an EMT. He came to protest, but he wound up helping a shooting victim.
Someone was yelling, they need a medic over there. So I started walking over here expecting someone to be like pepper sprayed or something like fairly benign. And then I saw someone on the ground and I started to run. And they had lifted his shirt most of the way up and it was covered in blood. The other two medics that ran over too started applying pressure. And I started to cut off his shirt and apply pressure. And then within like 10 seconds, the police were there and they did not want us to be there anymore.
Meanwhile, Yiannopoulos was speaking inside. Some protesters wore face masks. They said their goal was to stop Yiannopoulos from speaking. A few of them threw paintballs and even bricks and scuffled with people waiting to get inside. Other protesters supported his right to speak, but they peacefully opposed his message. Yiannopoulos often insults and belittles people based on their gender or other physical attributes. Max Kaplan is a UW senior. He stood in a long line hoping to see the controversial speaker.
I feel like living in Seattle, you only hear one side of things, and it's nice to come down here and hear the other side, I guess.
Seattle Mayor Ed Murray said the city supports the right to protest, but does not tolerate any violence. In Seattle, I'm John Ryan, KUOW News.
Seattle's a great place to visit because it has, I guess you could say, a little bit of everything, but I like to think of it as a lot of everything.
The results of the recent presidential election have revealed stark divisions in this country. Red versus blue and rural versus urban, and that's especially clear in Seattle, a city known for its liberal politics. This prompted a question for KUOW's Local Wonder.
This is Ray Neal in Burien, Washington. My question is, has Seattle always been politically progressive?
We sent out KUOW's Caroline Chamberlain to answer Ray's question.
So Seattle has a long history of progressive politics, and many politicians who visit to campaign here treat it like a badge of honor. Here's Senator Bernie Sanders at a rally last year.
You know, I think Seattle is ready for a political revolution.
But this picture of progressive Seattle isn't the full story. There are a number of things Seattle has done in the past that were blatantly not progressive.
Seattle supported the internment of the Japanese during World War II. Seattleites tried to eject Chinese residents from the city. One of the most glaring is our history of redlining.
That's Knut Berger. He's a writer for Crosscut. And he says many of the moments when Seattle has failed to live up to its progressive reputation center on one issue.
You know, a lot of them have to do with race.
An example of this is an open housing ordinance Seattle voted on in 1964. The ordinance would make it illegal to discriminate against people of color who want to buy or rent housing in Seattle. At the time, people of color could live in approximately 10% of the city due to restrictive covenants and redlining. Supporters and opponents of the ordinance gathered for a public hearing in October 1963.
This is not a public housing ordinance. This is a thought control bill.
That was homeowner Nancy McGee explaining before city council why she opposed it.
I do not oppose this law because it deprives one race and gives to another. I object because it deprives all of us of a basic freedom.
Reverend John Hurst Adams also spoke at the meeting, and he supported the law.
The problems of prejudice, segregation, and discrimination in America are the moral problems of the white community. We know this, and you know this. Your right and resolute action is the only answer, and your capacity to take that action is the only debate. A clear choice is yours.
Seattle voted down the open housing ordinance by a 2-1 margin. The outcome of the vote affected people like Norbert Brooks personally. He's the former executive director of the King County NAACP. It wasn't easy for him to buy a home here back then.
This is a house that I purchased many moons ago. And at the time, we were the first black to buy a house in the Newport Hills. And it was an experience.
Norbert had to buy it through a white man who pretended that he wanted the house. This was after the seller declined to sell it to Norbert after he saw that he was black. This experience in supposedly progressive Seattle was surprising for Norbert, who moved here from the South.
Coming from Louisiana, I was accustomed to being discriminated against, thinking that when I got to Seattle, that would not be the case. But Seattle was just as bad or worse. Because in Louisiana, I knew where I couldn't be. You were never told in Seattle where you couldn't be. They just had it fixed so that you could never get there.
Seattle's rejection of the open housing ordinance stands out because of what happened next at the national level. Just months later, President Lyndon B. Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act, a signature piece of the civil rights agenda. Quintard Taylor is a history professor at the University of Washington. He says this division between local and national ideals was common.
I think a lot of people saw civil rights as essentially a Southern problem. They saw racial discrimination, particularly discrimination in terms of voting, as a distinctly Southern problem. And therefore, they could support national efforts to eliminate restrictions on voting, while at the same time, they could vote for local restrictions on housing, particularly housing segregation.
While Seattle rejected open housing, other cities approved it. Cities like Wichita, Kansas, Beloit, Wisconsin, and Louisville, Kentucky. Seattle didn't reconsider its position on open housing until 1968, after Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. There were protests across the country and fears they would spread to Seattle. Quintard Taylor says Seattle City Council unanimously passed an open housing ordinance, at least in part, to maintain peace in the city. Back to Knute Berger.
It took Martin Luther King's assassination to get open housing in Seattle? I mean, that is really shocking to me. I mean, not shocking if you know the history, but if you haven't thought much about it and you think of Seattle as this liberal, progressive place, really, that has not come naturally. It had to be fought for.
It's important to note that even after many cities and states passed open housing laws, they weren't always enforced and discrimination continued. But Seattle was not progressive on this issue by any measure. But there have been times when Seattle thought it was being progressive in pursuing something, but in reality, it was a little more complicated.
A particular policy may seem to be progressive or thoughtful in the minds of one person, but not in the minds of others.
Matt Klingel is an environmental historian. He says an environmental cleanup in Seattle in the 60s demonstrates this paradox. Lake Washington was dirty, so dirty that its nickname was Lake Stinko. It was also in the backyard of many well-heeled residents. But when the city cleaned Lake Washington, its pollution was sent to the Duwamish River, where poorer residents lived. Klingel says that it's moments like these that can make marginalized groups suspicious of initiatives that are touted in the name of progress.
It's very easy for people living in a place like Seattle to imagine that they're on the right, but shift the perspective and that certitude quickly crumbles.
So, has Seattle always been progressive? No. But the term has changed over time and has always been full of contradictions. For example, Washington State was considered progressive when it banned alcohol in 1916. A century later, Washington hit another progressive milestone when it legalized marijuana. So what is progressive? That depends on who you're asking and when. In Seattle, I'm Caroline Chamberlain for KOW's Local Wonder. Living way out. Nigga, go
home. Spray painted on your house. The kids living there say they're afraid to go to sleep. Marnie Vance, their mother, says they wake up almost every morning to a new horrible racist message.
N-word, leave now, your time is up.
They've woken up to racial slurs day in and day out for months.
Spray paint been on my house like every other day and week. Like, nonstop.
Marnie Vance, who rents this home on Flint's East Side, says the messages are getting more threatening.
It's, like, upsetting because my kids have to wake up to it.
She says they destroyed her window screen, tried to break in, and even threw a dead cat in her yard.
And we just scared to, you know, even be here. Like, at night, we can't sleep.
She admits having a small disagreement with one of her neighbors a while back, but it was resolved. Marnie says she can't imagine who would keep terrorizing her family.
Leave us alone because I'm not a bad neighbor. I don't, you know, I'm not a bad person. My kids not bad kids. Like, what do they want from us?
She hit her breaking point this week when she found her back doorknob tied to the railing, keeping her from being able to get out.
And then they seen the rope tied to the door. They like, Mom, what's gonna happen next? And I'm like, I don't know.
She's working on getting money together so they can move. But in the meantime, they're forced to deal with it.
I thought I was safe in this neighborhood, but I'm not. I don't feel safe. I don't even feel like this home.
Marnie tells me she does have security cameras set up, but whoever is doing this moves the cameras so they can't be seen. She has called Flint police several times and filed a police report. In studio, I'm Jessica Dupnack, ABC 12 News.
I was the first, one of the first. My first day was state trooper coming, putting me in the back seat of the car, and meeting the other black kids with six of us. And seeing all of those parents and also KKK members having signs and throwing cans at us, spitting at us. We lived in the threat of death every day, every day. So I was just lost in this vacuum between integration and segregation and racism. That was my childhood. I was angry for years. Angry. Very angry.
A mother is outraged after her third grade son comes home from school with three of his teeth missing. She says his elementary school performed a dental procedure that she never knew about. Devin Bartolotta has more on what happened.
A Baltimore City mom is looking for answers. Why did the school allow serious dental work without even giving her a call? Nine-year-old Michael is still brought to tears by the pain.
I'm sorry, baby.
He's now missing three teeth, pulled out by a dental program visiting his school.
And then two on this side, one top and one bottom.
His mother, Shonda Fleming, tells WJZ she was never notified that the procedure was happening.
I'm angry about this. I don't think that it should have happened like that.
Baltimore City Schools says Fleming signed a permission slip, but she thought it was for routine cleanings and was blindsided when Michael came home with a swollen mouth.
They just said they was going to clean my teeth.
But there's more. The procedure caused Michael to miss the bus, meaning he had to walk almost a full mile to get back home.
He walked home alone after having three teeth extracted from his mouth. Like he could have fell out or anything.
These school dental programs became more common after a Prince George's County boy died from an infected tooth in 2007. Baltimore Public Schools declining WJZ's request for comment still has not answered some major questions. Why didn't the school alert the mother? Why was Michael allowed to walk home alone? And why wasn't he given medication after the procedure?
I just don't understand how a school or a company can take it in their hands to do something like this to a child.
A third grader now healing up, and this Baltimore mom on the mission for answers. Again, Baltimore City Schools declined WJZ's request for comment, citing privacy and HIPAA laws. Back to you.
Devin, thank you. Fleming says that her son was already scheduled to see a family dentist on Monday.
Y'all niggas, and you gonna be niggas forever, just like us, niggas.
Nigga!
Members of New Brunswick's Black community say the time has come to bury a relic of the past, a word that was once used in polite company, but is now considered offensive by a great many people. That word is Negro, and it's still being used as a name for roads, neighborhoods, even a historic breakwater in the province. CTV's Mike Cameron has more.
In 1844, it was called Negro Point.
Ralph Thomas looks through documents related to this familiar site, the breakwater to Partridge Island. It's also called the Negro Point Breakwater, one of three places in St. John with the word Negro in the name. Thomas says Negro is too close to the other N-word.
But it's surprising to be able to go to some of the communities and they're still saying you live on N Hill. And it's not Negro that they're saying. And I'm saying, well, why is that? You know, and it hurts people. It's derogatory. It's demeaning.
And even most of my own people didn't realize where the word Negro come from. Through research, we found out it was a Spanish word.
Historian David Peters says the word has been outdated for decades.
And we started educating ourselves and reading more deeply and researching. And we're not Spanish. Why are we using that word? And why is everyone else using it to refer to we, the black people?
The city of St. John is being asked to change at least three place names that include the word.
But now it's almost like an offensive word, like, you know, it offends you, where you feel kind of awful inside, I think, when you hear that word. So I'm certainly 100% for changing the names.
If the word Negro is removed from this location and from other locations in St. John and elsewhere in New Brunswick, some say they should be renamed to honor people who have made a contribution to the black community. For one, Thomas suggests Fred Hodges.
Hodges Point, because it would be named after an outstanding black person whose family were black loyalists.
Aside from the Partridge Island breakwater, the Black Historical Society says Negro Head in Lorneville should also be renamed.
The province of New Brunswick has also taken steps to change a handful of place names that included the word in question. Here in St. John Council is widely expected tonight to set the wheels in motion to do likewise. Bruce.
All right. Thank you, Mike.
You're welcome.
CTV's Mike Cameron reporting live tonight from St. John.
I've seen what's around the corner. I've seen what's over the horizon. And I promise you, you niggas have nothing to celebrate. And no, I won't get there with you. I'm going to Canada.
But right off the top of the show, I'd like to talk about something that's been going down within the York Region District School Board. There was a meeting of that school board back in November. And during the proceedings, or shortly thereafterwards, there was a parent who was speaking to the media. A school trustee by the name of Nancy Elgee saw that this parent was speaking to the media and made a comment about that parent using a word that I am not allowed to say on this radio station because it is so vile and vulgar. But so that everybody who's listening knows, the word that I am referring to, which trustee Nancy Elgee called a parent within the York District School Board, is spelled N-I-G-G-E-R. And if you don't know that word, it is a word that has been used to dehumanize black people for centuries.
Nigger!
Nancy Elgee first denied that the accusation she had used this word had any merit to it. And since that time, after an investigation at the board, she has actually apologized for using this language. But Nancy Elgee has not resigned. The parent who she directed this remark to is Charlene Grant. Charlene Grant and her partner, Garth Bob, are both joining me in studio this afternoon. Thank you to both of you for being here.
Thanks.
Thank you for having me.
Charlene, can you give us a little bit more of the context?
Context.
Of what happened when you were talking to the media at this meeting and how you found out that Nancy Elgee, the trustee, had made this comment about you since you actually weren't aware at the time.
No. So it was back in November. We were the only parents at the meeting at the time where they were supposed to be discussing the letter that was written by Superintendent Cecil Roach. So after the meeting, myself and my husband were off to the side talking to the media, giving an interview about what we heard. And the trustees as well as staff were in another room within eyesight, so we could have seen that. We saw them. And I guess the word was used, the comment was made. We weren't made aware of it until, I believe, the second week of December. And I was surprised, like I was shocked by the fact that it was said. Not that it was said, but the way in which it was said. I mean, here we are fighting and trying to get the board not to discriminate against our son. And now I'm going to have to defend the fact that I'm being referred to as the end parent because I was talking to the media.
Right. And just specifically to clarify for our audience, the understanding that you have from staff and from other officials who were at this meeting who heard this comment mm-hmm. was that you can't say the word on the air, but could you just say the phrase that was uttered without using this word?
Sure. Is that the end parent speaking to the media again?
Is that the N-word parent speaking to the media again?
That's it.
Yeah. I was also shocked when I heard about it. And even people who in our group of parents that are struggling against the board here were a little hesitant to tell us that it had been done after, because they found out before we did, just because it was so offensive and they thought that we would be offended by it. I was shocked at how we were pretty much almost given a smoking gun, because it is very hard to prove subtle racism. It puts the onus on the victimized to prove. We have to prove that we're not paranoid, that we're not using the race card. But we were talking about systemic racism within the board, and here is one of the trustees that have been given the trust of the public saying this about a parent that is complaining and advocating for their child. I mean,
I just want to clarify something as well. Because Nancy Elgee has said in media reports that she was not saying this about you, Charlene, that she was actually repeating a complaint that you had about your son that she heard in the media. But you have never alleged that your son was called the N-word by anyone.
Son was never called the N-word, and I've never said that. One. Two, was never mentioned in the media that my son was called the N-word.
So when you heard that that was her explanation, what did you think?
That never happened. I thought that's a poor excuse from the way in which we were told it was said towards us. And what you have to understand, this happened when Anna DiBartolo was the chair. This was brought to her. And, I mean, they decided to use Policy 240 to discipline or to do their investigation under Director Parapelli. And it seems,
just so people know, Policy 240 is a York Region staff policy about friendly workplaces, hospitable workplaces.
Yeah. Absolutely. And this is a policy that holds no merit. When the investigation is done, no one gets to hear about the result of it. Had the media not been so focused on this story, we wouldn't have even gotten an apology. It would have been, again, we can't disclose the information, which is what we've been complaining about, the transparency that the board's lacking.
But here's what I think is striking. When there was allegations of Islamophobia at Sir Wilfrid Laurier, if you read the letter that was in response to the minister's request, they said that there was a miscommunication about policy. Right. There was a policy that they should have used and they didn't use that policy, and parents were confused about the policy that should have been used. And now there seems to be another miscommunication about which policy should be used. Mm-hmm. It speaks more to the fact that they're trying to use this policy because they know if they put it under this policy of workplace, then nobody can find out what happens. Right. So it's their pattern, and their pattern is coming out. The more they struggle against this, the more that things are coming out, as opposed to just saying, you know what, there is a problem. Let's work with the parents and try and come up with a solution. Stop fighting about this. But the director is so stubborn and he does not want to take ownership for everything that is happening under his watch.
I want to ask about the larger issue that brought you to before the board in the first place, which is that, as you mentioned, you've been fighting on behalf of your son, who is himself experiencing discrimination within the York Region District School Board. Can you talk briefly about the kind of things that your son has been experiencing as a student?
So my son started grade 9 in 2015, and from the moment he walked into the school, just to give you an example, we have over 70 incidences where my son, three teachers, the principal, have made his life miserable. No child should have to go to school under such scrutiny. For example, one of his teacher told him, we know you're athletic, but you don't need to showcase your talent. You need to tone it down. This is not the place for that. Another gym teacher told his entire class, go check the locker, because he's in there. We're not sure if he's in there stealing. Wow. And again, the board made excuses for him. The board made excuses for this, saying the teacher was only looking out for the student item. And I asked the question, who was looking out for my son? And, you know, his soccer coach, when he told her he can't stay for soccer practice, she told him, if you miss another soccer practice because of your religious event, you will never be on this. You will be kicked off the soccer team and you will never play sports in this school ever again. Those are just a few. There's so many.
Yeah. And I'm sorry we don't have time to get deeper into this, but it shows what we've talked about on this program before, which is that there seems to be a system-wide problem in the York Region Board with parents such as yourselves complaining about these kinds of issues. I just want to ask you finally, in the last few moments that we have, what are you hoping now in terms of what happens with Trustee Nancy LG? Because she sent you an email apologizing for her language, but she plans to remain in her position. And I want to know how you two feel about that.
I'm relying and I'm hoping other trustees come forward. I want them to put Nancy in that hot seat and force her to do something. You know, the reason why bullies are so successful, because bystanders allow them to be. If bystanders don't do anything, this is the result of it. I'm hoping if the trustee is not able to come to some kind of agreement, figure out what policy should have been used and use that policy and get Nancy to resign. Or we have either the minister comes in and deal with the board entirely. And this all happened on the Director Parapalli, and he needs to go.
The trustees got to ask themselves, when history is telling this story about the York District School Board and incidences of systemic racism, how did those trustees deal with that? When this incident came up, how did they vote? Did they stand up and say, we got to stand up for the community and this is wrong and they're going to force LG to resign? What is the director going to say? How is his legacy going to be? And if those trustees don't stand up and do the right thing, then we're willing to organize and do whatever we can to get trustees in that are going to look out for parents and students within the York District School Board.
Charlene Grant, Garth Bob, thank you so much. I know it's very difficult to have to go through this, but I appreciate both of you coming on the airwaves today to talk to us.
Thank you for having us.
I decided to get on the phone when I read about this story a couple of days ago, and I decided I would call all of the York Region District School Board trustees to find out what they thought about one of their colleagues using this kind of language. It was actually not that easy to get anybody on the phone, and nor have I really seen any comments made by school board trustees explaining what they think about this in York Region, explaining what they think their colleagues' responsibilities are here. It's been a lot of silence. I was able to actually get one trustee on the line. He said some very interesting things, which I'm going to share with you. But first, I actually want to talk about the director of the York Region District School Board, who is J. Philip Parapalli. And he issued a statement a couple of days ago saying, we did an investigation, which you heard us referring to last segment, and now the investigation is over. Parapalli said, we don't tolerate racism at the York Region District School Board. So I asked his spokesperson, well, if you don't tolerate racism, why such a weak response to such a vile, vile incident? And here's how part of that conversation sounded. How can somebody who calls somebody a nigger be allowed to continue in their position and for the board to simultaneously say, well, we don't tolerate racism? That to me says the board does not consider calling somebody a nigger to be racism because they're tolerating it.
Well, I would say, you know, racism of any kind is unacceptable, and we would take action anytime there's allegations made. In this particular case, the moment that staff were made aware of that allegation, staff did undertake an investigation.
So that's Licinio Miguelo, who is a spokesperson for the York Region District School Board, saying, as soon as we heard about this, we took action. Well, how did they take action? The board took action, as we mentioned last segment, by investigating Nancy Elgee under a policy that has no teeth. The policy that Nancy Elgee was investigated under is not able to hold trustees accountable for their behavior because it's not for trustees. It's a policy for staff at the York Region District School Board. And as we mentioned, that policy means that when the board investigates, it keeps the results of its investigation a secret. So even though the investigation into this racial slur by Nancy Elgee has been investigated, the board won't tell us what the result of the investigation was. They are keeping that to themselves. As I mentioned, I called every single trustee of the York Region District School Board to try and get comment on this. The only person who I was able to get a public comment on this from was Peter Adams Lachowski, who is the school board's trustee for Aurora and King in York Region. Peter Adams Lachowski said some pretty unbelievable things to me during our conversation. He said that he was vaguely familiar with the fact that this incident had taken place, but it became very clear to me during our conversation that actually he was pretty familiar with it indeed and had some defenses for Nancy Elgee. But I want to read you a direct quote from what Peter Adams Lachowski, the trustee for Aurora and King, said. This is a direct quote. "I don't know that this would be a crucifixion offense. I'm not the judge or the jury. It's not my position to be a judge based on things I've heard. If I was there, I would have a different perspective, perhaps. Nancy's business is her business. I'm not going to condemn someone I've worked with for over 10 years over a mishap." Unquote. That's Peter Adams Lachowski saying that he would not condemn a colleague for using the N-word. He called that a mishap. He also told me that it's not a racial thing to me. This is a York Region School Board trustee telling me that one of his colleagues calling someone the N-word is not a racial thing to him. And when Peter Adams Lachowski realized that I was typing all of his comments down during our conversation, he asked me, "Are you typing?" And I said, "Yes, I'm documenting everything you say." And he told me that I should go back to my basement and get on YouTube. That was what Peter Adams Lachowski said to me when I asked him about this, and when I told him I was documenting everything that he had to say. So this idea that this is not just a problem with Nancy Elgee, that this is a problem across the board, makes perfect sense to me after trying to call trustees and getting almost no response, after seeing that almost no trustee is willing to go public and talk about this disgraceful and racist behavior and call for Nancy Elgee to resign. There is a big problem at the York Region District School Board, but I've got to tell you all something. I'm shocked that Nancy Elgee actually thinks that she is going to get away with this without resigning. And it tells me that she must not know Black people too well. Because Nancy, if you actually think, and I know you're listening, if you actually think that Black parents and Black students across the York Region District School Board are going to forgive you using this word and saying now it's time to move on, that you are going to successfully portray yourself as the victim for being asked to be accountable for this heinous language, you don't know Black people. I think that you should resign, Nancy Elgee, because if you don't, there is going to be so much condemnation and anger, the unbelievable anger that I have heard about in the couple of days that I have been sharing this story on social media. People are outraged, nor can they believe that somebody hasn't taken action already. But of course, as an elected official, as a politician, Nancy Elge can't be fired. The only real way that I understand that that could happen is that it's possible, I hear, for the Minister of Education at the province to step in and remove a trustee. And I don't know when the last time that ever happened was, and I bet you that it's very unlikely to happen in this case, because why would the province want to get themselves involved in something so nasty? However, somebody is going to have to do something. And I think that that somebody is going to have to be Nancy Elge. She's going to have to take responsibility for using this language. What is so unbelievable to me, too, is that Nancy Elge, as I mentioned last segment, said that I wasn't saying this about the family. I had heard somebody else in the media use this language about them, and I accidentally repeated it. Now, I can say two things about that. Number one, I don't think Nancy Elge heard somebody else using the N-word in the media and accidentally repeated it while she happened to be looking at Charlene Grant, a black woman, at a board meeting. That doesn't fly with me. You know why? Because as I told you off the top of this broadcast, I'm not allowed to use that word. And in the newspaper, you will not see that word, the N-word, as it's called, because we don't use it. We don't print it. We don't broadcast it. So what media is Nancy Elge talking about that she just heard this comment on in the media and accidentally repeated it? But even if we were to believe that that was true, you're looking at a black woman at a meeting speaking to the media and saying, is that N-word parent talking to the media again? And you call that an accident? Do you actually think that black people in the greater Toronto area are going to buy that, Nancy Elge? Let me be the first to tell you, we're not. And you should step down. And the calls for you to do so are only going to increase with your every resistance to accountability.
The most impotent creature in the form of a person on this planet.
Armed men and a separate group of young boys took it upon themselves to patrol the neighborhood where a Fort Worth woman and her two daughters were arrested last month. In video posted to Facebook, you can see men with rifles walking down the area where Officer William Martin arrested Jacqueline Craig and her two daughters a month ago. The group says they are there to show the Craig family they are protected as Officer Martin again begins his patrols back in that same neighborhood. The video shows Fort Worth officers who were called to the scene put the men in handcuffs for a while. Fox 4's Allison Harris there explains what happened next. Allison.
Brandon, we don't know who these people are, and neither did Jacqueline Craig. They are two separate groups, one several armed men, another group of young children led by at least one man. Neighbors were completely caught off guard by this, some feeling threatened. Armed men, two or three of them carrying assault rifles, patrolled the streets of a Fort Worth neighborhood Saturday. A group of about 20 young people who showed up in a bus, children and teens learning self-defense, prepared to defend Jacqueline Craig, the Fort Worth mother who called 911 last month to report a neighbor had choked her 7-year-old son. Instead, Officer William Martin forcefully arrested her and two of her daughters, seen in the video that's gone viral. The show of support Saturday was not planned and only lasted about 20 minutes before neighbors called police and the armed men left. People who live there near Trail Lake Drive and Alta Mesa Boulevard felt it disrupted their weekend, saying one of the men was yelling through a loudspeaker and others were yelling profanities. More importantly, neighbors who asked to remain anonymous thought the patrol could have become violent.
I didn't find anything alarming myself. I didn't find anything out of the norm. Police officers have guns, but they don't protect.
Craig family spokesperson Roderick Smith expressed Jacqueline's appreciation.
She said it meant a lot to have complete strangers come and try to protect her when the individuals that she paid, which is the Fort Worth Police Department, failed to do so.
Smith believes this patrol would never have happened if Officer Martin, who was suspended for 10 days without pay, were not being reassigned to the same part of the community, including Jacqueline Craig's own neighborhood.
If a predator know where you stay, you're still at risk, right? So when it comes down to it, like they say, you know, they know the predator, which is the officer, know where she at, so they want to make sure she's protected.
Fort Worth police are not commenting on the incident today, but they did say that several neighbors called them, and that's why they responded out there. You can see at the end of some of the video that we have, officers talking to the armed men, asking them to put their guns down, putting them in handcuffs, talking to them some more, and then letting them out of their handcuffs. No one was arrested. Brandon.
All right, Allison Harris, live in Fort Worth. Thank you.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast. Hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, January 28th, 2017. So I have been told. Rough week for my voice. Victim of racism, white supremacy. Compensatory call-in each and every Saturday, same time, 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central, 6 p.m. Pacific. Looking forward to hearing from victims of racism, views, thoughts on things that have taken place over the last 7 days. The number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6. If you would like to participate, the number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. It just speeds up the process if you press star 61 that way. I'll see your hand on the screen. We can get you on the line. A couple quick things before we get to our callers. We are listener-supported, counter-racist radio. Invest. If you think the program is constructive, you can hit our blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you're not interested in PayPal or just would choose to avoid that, you can drop us an email and we will get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all the folks who have supported, invested in us over the last 8 years. I hope the program continues to be worthy of your time and energy. We are also on SoundCloud. We got our investment from Student for Justice a few weeks back. Other people have supported as well, but we are on SoundCloud. All of the programs from this week are available on SoundCloud, and some people have already volunteered to help upload the entire archives to SoundCloud. I guess they putting it in chronological order would be very challenging at SoundCloud, but at least all of the material can be stored there, and then it'll have the correct dates for when all of the programs aired. But we can talk about all that as we go. A couple quick things that I wanted to point out before we get to callers. Number one, the last audio segment that you heard, that was from this past weekend when that happened down in Texas. And my editor at Atlanta Black Star shared that report with me for a piece that I'm working on currently. And it stood out. I hear regularly, even from some Cows listeners, you know, black people need to get guns and that'll show these white people. And I've stated consistently the pattern, which you just heard, that's the pattern that I've seen consistently when black people get firearms and go out to make some sort of insurrectionary public stance. to show flex their muscle, if you will, armed white Gestapo tends to come out and handle that easily. Easily. I think they said within 20 minutes they had the entire group of these armed folks in handcuffs on the ground, disarmed. We can't lie to ourselves about what we're dealing with. Illustration of what domination looks like. Next, Desmond Cole, outstanding journalistic effort. Wowee. I was so impressed and just enjoyed it thoroughly, listening to his report in Canada covering white supremacy and education. This race soldier, Nancy Elge, who calls this black parent a nigger, and then lies about it, and then comes back and is willing to acknowledge, yeah, I called her a nigger, yeah, but I'm not going to resign. I'm willing to take some, you know, what they call sensitivity training. But, oh, no, I'm not going to, you know, give up my position. I just thought it was brilliant. And then pointing out the culpability of her white colleagues, that they're not willing to step up and do anything about this. Her calling a parent a nigger, just outstanding. He wrote about this incident as well. That was from his weekly talk radio program on Sundays, but he also wrote about this in the Toronto Star, and I'll post that as well. It's linked in the description at Black Talk Radio Network. But wowee, outstanding effort. I've played quite a few clips from Mr. Cole over the years, and yeah, just thought that was definitely worthy of recognition for outstanding counter-racist work. Global problem, Canada, state that again. Also, in connection with the Desmond Cole report, I listened to that, I believe, on, I think it was technically Thursday morning, but Wednesday evening. I'm listening to that, and Mr. Cole's segment ends. It's on iHeartRadio. So Mr. Cole's segment ends, and they play like a commercial, and then they just go to other content, right? On that's I presumably also Canadian public radio or radio content. So I recognize that Mr. Cole's segment has ended, and it's 3 a.m. That's important for context. It's late. I'm about to settle in and have a rest. The show ends, they go to a commercial, and they're talking about just random goofiness. My mind is like everywhere, and they're just talking about random goofiness. So I go to turn off the radio, and the guy says, it's National Fluoride Day, which just further signaled to me, what are they even talking about? This is so stupid. So as my finger is going out to turn off the radio, he said, so it's National Fluoride Day, which will be followed by Plaque History Month. I know my voice is bad today. So plaque as in pigs plaque, like the material that you try to remove from your teeth, that you will hear mentioned in toothpaste commercials or when you go to the dentist. Plaque History Month. And I mean, literally, as he finished the word month, my finger hit the button to silence the radio, and I was frozen, thinking, did I just hear a racist joke? I've never heard of plaque with a P, Plaque History Month. Next month, I am told, is Black History Month, meaning black people, victims of white supremacy, in February, as I have been told. That's coming up in a matter of days. And I just thought, wow, the conflation of Plaque History Month, again, plaque. And I thought when I was telling other people, asking their opinion, I thought, Emmy, she made a great point. She said, I think plaque generally, that is the substance that blocks the whiteness of your teeth. But to conflate that with Black History Month, where I already hear tons of white people complain about Black History Month. We hate this. It's blocking all the glory of our white forefathers and foremothers like the great Thomas Jefferson and George Washington and Woodrow Wilson and Margaret Sanger, the infamous. It's blocking out time where we could be studying and learning about all of these wonderful whites who helped us keep our foot on you niggers' neck. We got to stop and learn about George Washington Carver and peanuts, right? It's standard. I think it's a racist joke. The only thing I regret, two regrets, number one, I could have recorded this so I could have just played the entire commercial for you all. I literally had just stopped recording about seconds, like maybe 20 seconds before this commercial aired. Two, I wish I had not stopped the radio because then I would have heard the full context. I literally, it did not register in my brain computer until I had stopped it. And then even then I had to think about what I had just heard because it was just it is a racist joke. A lot of the people, when I shared this on my Facebook page, a lot of the people that responded said they too thought it was a racist joke for a lot of the same reasons that I just articulated here. If you have comments on that, feel free. We'll get to the callers. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. *61, really. Again, if you could take about 5 minutes or less to share your thoughts, views, that way we'll make sure everybody gets an opportunity to share and no metaphors for the compensatory call-in. A lot of times racists, they use metaphors to deceive, to spread confusion. They deliberately will compare things that are not equivalent. This will be done on a regular basis. Often victims, we will do this as well in our struggles to articulate our views on counter-racism, white supremacy. A lot of times we're still thinking about our conclusion on a particular concept or an idea. So sometimes in our struggle to find words to convey our thoughts, we will employ a metaphor, and sometimes those metaphors do not clearly articulate our ideas. They just add to the confusion. So if we could be explicit, right to the point, exact with what we're saying, and no metaphors, that would be greatly appreciated. I will prompt about that. I make errors with that myself. We're all still learning, but just something that we want to be mindful about as we converse. Thank you kindly. The first few people who dialed in who have a hand up, your line should be open. Feel free.
Can I speak? Hello?
Yes, sir.
Oh, hey, how you doing?
Right.
How you doing, Gus? Real quick, the Texas incident, I heard about that. It's interesting. I'm wondering if Texas is an open carry state. Over the years, we've been hearing about numerous gun marches by white people. I haven't heard any white people being detained. It's also to further to kind of piggyback off your position on, you know, black people need to arm themselves. I think that's the same as when black people talk about group economics, you know, things of that nature. Tulsa, Oklahoma, from what I've heard, financially they had all their everything in order financially, and racist white man, racist white woman destroyed the town. Just as I was listening to the broadcast, I just seen an article stating that Barack Obama has made $20 million since being in office. You know, just to make a note of that. I'm gonna read about that article later. I also listened to an old archive of yours when you did an audio read on the Turner Diaries. That was during the time of Barack Obama and Mitt Romney was going head to head for the presidency. I think that that book and your commentary and that those old archives are very, very relevant today. So if anybody, if anybody has heard the Cows broadcast on the Turner Diaries, that is so relevant today. Right now, that's basically all I have to say. For now.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you, Gus, and to the other callers and the listeners. I hope you feel better. I hear your voice sounds fairly irritated. You can probably check pineapple juice, especially if it's warm. It'll help you with your throat if it's sore or severely irritated. That's very, very good for helping to rid yourself of a sore throat. So I hope you feel better. Weirdly enough, right after I had the oral surgery, I got bronchitis. So I'm trying to get better, too. So I hope you feel better. To touch on the clips this evening, phenomenal. I wanted to ask, to answer first the question about whether or not that was a racist joke. I agree emphatically that it was a racist joke. In my opinion, the person was equating Black History Month with waste, something that needs to be neutralized and removed, which was kind of what you alluded to previously, to white people's agitation with the idea of Black History Month. So absolutely, in my opinion, I could be wrong, but in my opinion, definitely it was a racist joke. The clip on the marijuana app, I think that that's going to be a serious problem, simply because regardless, and I heard the officer say that if you pass the test by a specific number of points, that you cannot be arrested by the officer. That is an absolute lie. Officers have the law on their side, whatever that means. And as a result, they will be able to use discretion. So if they want to arrest you, they will definitely arrest you regardless of what that test says, especially if you are a non-white person. The clip on Marcus Garvey, I thought it was really great. Says a lot that President Obama did not actually commute his sentence or exonerate him for being set up, which essentially is what happened to him. He was one of African people's greatest visionaries, and his name was definitely sullied. And it was good to hear from his son. His other son is a lecturer as well. I heard a lecture from him back in the days with Dr. Ben. And he's also following the traditions of his father. I think that President Obama did not want to connect it with him because he is considered the father of modern Pan-Africanism. And he did not want anything to do with Africa on the level of a Marcus Garvey because it would have tarnished his reputation amongst the more powerful whites he was trying to work with. That's my opinion. Again, I could be wrong. The clip about Seattle, he was talking about the housing, and the person who was interviewed said that Seattle, in his opinion, was worse than Louisiana, because at least in Louisiana, you knew where you could not be. In Seattle, he said, you didn't know where you couldn't be. And to me, that is what refinement in white supremacy looks like in the system of white supremacy, because the refinement, when I see white people refining their practices, it breeds more confusion amongst the victims of white supremacy. So as a result, to me, that is a great example of what refinement looks like and how it damages the psyche of the victims even further. The woman whose son had his three teeth pulled just shows the danger. Again, I say this constantly, sending our children to schools controlled and dominated by white people. It also proves again that Black people do not have any control over not only our own lives and bodies, but even the lives and bodies of our children. And even the fact that they're not even addressing the situation for the parents speaks volumes to the power of the system of white supremacy and the suppression of Black people and the ignoring of Black people when we honestly speak about truthful things that have been done to them, and they ignore it. So kind of like what I discussed yesterday on the Delectable Negro. Again, big up to Desmond Cole for Black Self-Respect. I thought that was just incredible, and it was great, and I hope that they do get her, Nancy Elgey, I hope they get her racist behind up out of there. I wanted to report that recently I saw that a woman named Carolyn Bryant, who is the racist white female mayonnaise that came out and set up Emmett Till to be murdered came out and said that she lied. It was a CBS report. I can send you the video clip, Gus. But she came out and basically said it was reported in the book that she lied on Emmett Till. So this young man was killed in such a heinous way for nothing. His mother then died prematurely due to the murder of her son. All of this happened because of a white female. So again, remember the power and danger of the white woman. That just speaks volumes to that. I'll send you the clip, Gus. And I had a question for you. In regards to Vincent Woodard, I wanted to know if you can expand on how he died. I knew that he did pass away, but I never was able to find out or determine what took his life. So I just wanted to ask if you had that information. Thank you and for a great show. I hope you heal as quickly as possible. And I'll meet my line.
Mm. Thank you kindly. I have struggled myself to find out more information about Mr. Woodard, who wrote The Delectable Negro that we just started reading yesterday, which is curious in and of itself. Like, even a lot of his, the obituaries that I've found, they're relatively short. It's difficult to find the archives. He died at such a young age and was a noted professor in Colorado. I would think that there would be more, it would be easier to find more information about him. I'm going to speak with Dr. Curry and see if he can recommend some sites that give more biographical information, just so we'll know exactly how he died, other things about, you know, his life and influences, just so we'll know more about the author. But I'm going to speak with Dr. Curry about that.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello to all the callers on the line. This is Kendra. I just had a few commentary. First, Evel Ford, non-white police officer kills a non-white police officer kills a white individual and goes to jail immediately. White police officer kills a non-white black individual, and it's guaranteed that that cop will get off. It's also guaranteed that racist man and racist woman will put a non-white person to answer for why the white individual wasn't charged. Secondly, I thought it was a strange question to pose to the author of The Price for Their Pound of Flesh when the interviewer asked, did enslaved individuals care about their cost? I thought that was a strange and highly inappropriate question. You know, I'm sure that that's the last thing enslaved males and females thought about was their cost as they were, you know, on the auction block. Lastly, when I heard the story of the young child who had his tooth extracted, medical apartheid came to mind. The idea that black people can withstand greater levels of pain than other groups of people. And just one more thing to the first individual who commented, I'm actually in the process of listening to the Turner Diary, so his commentary makes it a little more exciting for me to listen to the rest of it. Thank you very much, Gus.
I thought the same thing about that interview, The Price for Their Pound of Flesh. When the white interviewer asked that question, I thought the exact same thing. Like, how tacky, and this is the sort of question I would expect from a race soldier. The only caveat I could give is if this comes up, and this is a brand new book, so I'm looking forward to reading it, but is if that is addressed in the book and he felt, oh, okay, so I'll bring this up since she does address this in the book. But I would have to read, that would be the only exoneration. If it's not in the book, I would stand by what the same assessment that you had. How tacky, that's what I would expect from whites.
Can I be heard?
Hello? Go ahead, sir.
Go ahead, Richard.
Greetings, everyone.
Yes, sir, greetings.
I'll start with the... start with earlier in the week. I was just, this is basically my own either suspected work suspected racism or something that someone may have heard about. First thing, I was bumped into car to car. I'm talking about bumped into by white racist spec teacher at the high school that I worked at. And it's just been kind of like nagging me. No harm done to the car or anything. But when I got out to see on whether or not there was any damage, You know, I'm suspecting a white person anyway, that he may have done it on some kind of personal note. I'm not sure, for sure. It's just been nagging me in the head. Just thought I'd just mention that to others. There was an incident that I was involved in picking up something from a restaurant to go, and asked the person at the counter, non-white, non-black, perhaps, person, speak Spanish, and asked about whether or not my order was ready, and he looked at it, looked around for about 5 seconds, approximately, and then said no and went back to what he was doing, which was, well, not what he was doing, but a Spanish-speaking female, non-black, maybe white, and just entertained her. And I stopped him immediately and say, "Hey, wait a minute! I asked you about my order. You just went back to what you back to something else, and I need you to pay attention to what I'm asking you to do." And anyway, the good part about it was there was a non-white black female wearing her natural hairstyle, heavily melanated, because I call him an asshole. I call the guy an asshole. And she said, "You deserve," she told her fellow employee, "you deserved it." "You deserved it for ignoring him after he asked you to look for his order." And I thought that was amazing on her part. And so I mentioned in front of everybody that I just thanked her for her black self-respect. And she went to apologize on behalf. I just suggested to her that you don't have to apologize for him. That sort of thing happens a lot down here in South Florida. Some of us may suspect out of non-black people who speak Spanish down here in this area. The Reverend Jesse Lee Peterson, I just read this, made the comment that Trump is a white savior. And the reason why I brought it up is not to to criticize the Reverend Peterson, I would say VGQ, but I think an example of attempting to correct non-white people when they use a lot of them in his dissertation to white savior. First of all, the term white savior. And he was saying things like, we'll clean out, which is a metaphor, drugs, crimes, and another metaphor, thugs. You know, what does that exactly mean? Also, he used the metaphor, clean up the mess, what that means, which makes what he says, and I'm not the Reverend Peterson, but non-white people especially should not use metaphors because they would not get clarity. I would assume that he would expect clarity when someone's reading his article. Moving on, this week there were several, there was a report of several movies where non-white black people have been involved, either as actors or on the other side of the camera, and they're supposed to be up for Oscars and all kinds of other awards and whatever. But the ironic thing about one that's down here, supposed to be down here in South Florida, I forgot the name of the movie. I'm pretty sure some other people know the name of it. It's about a non-white black person and their sexually confused background. Their sexual confusion is a subject matter, a top subject matter in the movie. Mind you, now there's a lot more history of that particular area that could have been talked about, but nevertheless, that's something that I think about as far as something that's going to get a major award for is sexual confusion. Ironically, the area is probably the oldest or one of the oldest government housing projects in the history of this part of the world that is called the United States. And my attempted father actually was the first generation of children that grew up in that area. His nickname for it is called Pork and Beans. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Appreciate that, retired firefighter, M1. Were you going to comment, sir? Oh, are you there, M1? Not hearing you. Maybe he muted himself or stepped away. We'll make sure we pick him up as we roll. If you're there, M1, we're not hearing you. If you stepped away or what have you, need a moment for your area to get quiet, that's fine too. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you have commentary, feel free. And of course, folks, we wait for the day when my voice is having difficulties to decide that they want to spectate. Right on. Certainly, I would think there would be some observations on the first week of Trump being in the White House. I know some people even missed with workplace racism on Thursday. We didn't get all of the callers who had, you know, things they wanted to share with that. So we should be able to get that in as well, unless people are just spectating and just tuned in to hear what, you know, victims of racism had to say about what took place this past week.
Oh, Gus, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I wanted to. Yeah.
Oh, hang on one second. Hang on one second, because I think we did still miss some people. They're just lollygagging today. Like I said, any other folks that we have not heard from at all, if you have commentary, you should be with us.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. I just pressed a 6 foot. Yeah, this was a busy week. I'm about to hear about your voice. Just it, you know, you take it easy and, you know, preserve it. Because racism, white supremacy is definitely on this task. I was listening to, a firefighter from Florida when he suggested that the Oscars nominations, that was six total nominations this week. And I want to suggest that we not get distracted about what's really going on. We get six nominations and Trump becomes president. I mean, this is just a distraction. And listening to the clip about the child in Maryland getting this too distracted and walking a mile home without anesthesia. I mean, wow. That's amazing. I can only imagine that if that was to happen to my son, how I would feel. How I would be outraged and, to say the least. when you spoke to Ms. Malumba from Belgium earlier this week, I mean, it really resonated because I was thinking the same lines of what King Leopold II from Belgium, he maimed about 15 million Africans and killed. His name should be synonymous with Hitler. And I want to make a mission, my mission this year, to speak with nine whites to mention that, because I think that every action was like the Jewish people speak about Hitler. You know, they want him to be remembered for the atrocities in Germany. We should bring King Leopold II up. And man, it was so much happiness. I had been listening to Nellie Fuller's Visit to the Cows every day. There was some part where, you know, he makes reference to Gandhi and how he became a kind of racist. I mean, what else do we have to do? What else do we have to do? You know, what else is worth, you know, our time than devote to slaves? And it's so many things that happened this weekend, but I hope you feel better, Gus, and thanks for broadcasting the program in your condition. I hope you feel better. And I'm my line.
Yes, ma'am, we can hear you.
I only have a few observations this week. I have been trying to watch a little bit more, and I have noticed that on different news channels, MSNBC, they're definitely making a big deal about comparing the crowd at Trump's inauguration compared to the crowd at President Obama's inauguration the first time he was elected. I just thought that also definitely adds to distractions for victims of racism and supremacy. And he also, I also had heard that there were some bills that he had signed that I can't. If they don't come to mind right now, I know one of the first bills that he signed was making his inauguration the holiday, which I thought was a complete waste of time, probably another distraction in and of itself. MSNBC, how they were talking about how his, I think it was his press secretary, I guess they were saying like Trump must have, I'm sorry, that was on News One Now, how they were saying that Trump sent out his secretary to defend the differences between the inauguration crowd and on MSNBC, of course, were kind of defending it. And it definitely wasted a whole week on just the size of a crowd and not really take into account like what Trump is doing behind closed doors. And also I think he is trying to get rid of the Affordable Care Act just as he promised. The other thing that I've noticed, I think it was I can't remember who brought it up on some past shows on past Saturday shows, just talking about the commercials and the commercials. It seems like there's a lot of commercials now where you see a lot of half white, half black individuals, and not so much. And if you do see I'm assuming a full black individual, they are paired up with a white individual. So I just thought that was interesting as well. That's all I have for now. Thank you. I'll mute myself.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Greetings, beautiful people. The first thing about the child who had their teeth pulled at the school, I pulled that story up while I was listening to it because whoa. And I could not find the name of the company. And I feel like in that story, the name of the company should be stated, explicitly stated. This is the name of the group, the organization, the company, whatever it is that went into the school. It shouldn't just be hidden. And as far as I'm aware, I could be incorrect. Non-disclosure and HIPAA protects patients, protects individuals, protects clients, does not protect the company by saying that we can't release the name of the company because of HIPAA. HIPAA is about the patient. That's the company saying that we are under an obligation to protect your privacy information, your date of birth, your social, what medication you may be on, what you had done, or what are your treatment. The whole thing was terrible, and it's even more terrible that they're keeping that. So you can't even, like, if you get the paper in the mail or your child brings that home, you wouldn't be able to say, oh, this is the same group of people or organization that was in that other school that did that with that other child over there. And this is the same thing when they commit other atrocious crimes. You can't find their names. So when they go to other countries and they're raping folks, they never publish their names or their pictures or anything. And so, like, these terrible things are happening, and they just exist, like, they're just not pointed out. And I disagree with that 100%. I could be totally incorrect, or I could just invoke BGQ for myself, but the emotion over the word, is extremely non-constructive in my view, for many reasons, but in one particular reason, because the word of the term evokes or whatever so much emotional response, and kind of abstract view, that's also, like, excitement is erotic. And then, you know, we're reading The Delectable Negro, and so I think that emotional reaction every time that the word is used is erotic for a white person, that they get off by seeing us be emotional. And another way, us being emotional over the word is fodder for their consumption. And so I think, in addition to codifying black respect, in addition to codifying no name calling, that codifying no reaction to the N-word would just go a very long way, because even when they talk about it, they just enjoy talking about it, enjoy saying it. And I think it's just homoerotic and erotic all over. And I think that the term, the N-word, really, it's, I like that. I think the one thing out of that is that it emphasizes that we are not human, not human. I don't think that, and I know for myself, I can speak for myself, it doesn't hit home for me all the time that when white people look at me, they do not see another human being. They see something else. But whatever it is, it's not human. It's a quote-unquote, no, that's a metaphor. Anyway, just not human. And then I'll say, like, a couple things of my observations since the first week of being in office is the emboldenment of white people. And it's subtle. It's not like everyone, like, I'm in Virginia, just all of a sudden just came out with their Confederate flags and carrying their guns on their hips and, you know, calling me the N-word left and right every moment. But it is definitely pride that you can feel with white people, the men and women alike. I'll tell you a story really quick. So I'm in the gym. I'm walking out of the gym. There's an area where one to the right, closer to the offices, to the left, it's like machines. So it's like just a little walkway. And I'm walking close to the machine way. Now, I'm already in my, like, lane, so to speak. I'm where I need to be to walk. And this white man decides that he wants to get close. I'm already there, but he decides he's going to make this diagonal, come over there, and walk. So I'd already realized like what was going on, and I'm not moving. So it was an experience to see, well, what is this? So he didn't move until the last minute, where it would have been absolutely unavoidable for him to walk into me. We're making eye contact and everything. And I'm, you know, so just it's subtle, it's passive aggressive, but it's totally there. That always happens, but it's just more, I would say. And yeah, I have a little bit more. I'll say that just because I'm so I was so excited when it happened. True story. I actually met the Honorable Marcus Garvey's son, and I was making a joke. I had to take his ID to sign him in for the building. And at Garvey, I didn't know his son's name. So I said, you wouldn't be related to Marcus Garvey, would you? And then it just got quiet. And then I looked at him. Oh, my God, when I tell you I geeked so much, like jumping up and down. I even, like, later wrote him a card. I was like, oh, my God, we have to stay in contact. Da, 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 da. I got pictures and everything. I was like, you have no idea who you're even talking to. Like, why I'm so excited. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm not, you know, your father's work changed my life. So it's good to hear him speak on behalf of his father, because when I researched, I couldn't really find him being active in his father's work. So to hear him speak about it, and, you know, for whatever reason, I thought was good. So thank you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Awesome. This is Ken Steele, and I am reporting from Orange County tonight. And I wanted to add on to a comment that I made mention of last week, was that the changes that are happening under Trump are going to happen fast. And one news story that I read last week indicated that people were coming into the United States from Canada, and they were asked if they were pro-Trump or if they were anti-Trump by customs officials. And they admitted that they were anti-Trump. They thought that that would be no problem, that, you know, First Amendment, freedom of speech, Constitution. They thought that all of these things were in effect, and they gave a truthful answer to these customs officials. They were denied entry, and they were also denied entry when it was made apparent that they were going to join the Women's March. So that was another change that happened very quickly under President Donald Trump. And that goes into my comment for this week, is that they are really intensifying the energy with which they are persecuting those who opt to publicly speak out against this administration. They also reported that the Trump administration is now actively monitoring people's Facebooks for undisclosed purposes. I'm just letting everyone know that you have to watch what it is that you are putting out there. I'm also speaking to myself when I say this. You have to be very careful with what you are putting out there publicly about how you feel about any of these particular happenings or goings on. So be very, very mindful of what it is that you're putting out there. And to speak with about how it is, I don't know if this is a metaphor. it's palpable. I guess it's something that can be detected amongst the suspected white supremacists out there. They definitely seem to have been emboldened. That's the word that's being used to describe their behavior. And I'm noticing that their codification is becoming less and less. The decorum with which they're conducting themselves has gone down, and they are not feeling very confident about being able to harm non-white people, especially those of us who are classified as black. Another thing that I'm noticing is that a number in the wake of these bans that have taken place, these so-called Muslim bans, that and the moving forward with the plans for the wall, I'm noticing that suspected white supremacists belonging to other groups are now increasing their usage of quotes from Dr. Martin Luther King when speaking to victims of racism, especially those of us who are classified as black. They are making an effort to, to recruit many of us to join their protests and their marches. And I have advised victims of racism, do not join these protests. I participated in Ferguson protests, and that protest, if any of these other protests are like that protest, there's a high probability that one of these protests are going to erupt in violence, tremendous public displays of violence. And with a Donald Trump who is outwardly hostile toward protests, especially those regarding the treatment of non-white people or his targets, the potential for violence is very, very high. Do not participate in these protests. I strongly advise against it. They are building you, lists.
Will,
they are monitoring
hang tight
people,
right there, and, Mr. Steele. That's five. If we have extra time, you can continue your comment, but hopefully folks heard your warning about participating in this. I think Dr. Welsing gave us a similar sentiment back in 2014. Do we have other folks that we have not heard from at all who have commentary? Any people that we have not heard from at all? Yes, sir.
All right. Thank you, Gus. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners, and callers. First thing I'm going to start on is there's been a term that's been used in the media. I think it's called alternative facts. And when I was on the job, they were saying how that book, 1984, like the sales been increasing, I guess, you know, people trying to purchase that book, I guess, because of the recent use of the term. So I was thinking about how that word does sound very, I guess, unique and more importantly, confusing, because it doesn't make sense the more you think about the term. There was a story happened down here in my area where there was a suspected racist on the UF campus. He was wearing a swastika in one report, and he was just basically defending the Nazi regime back in history and just basically saying, you know, well, how can anybody prove that things were done to them back in those times? Jewish people and black people and whatnot. So he was wearing this thing And apparently he was attacked a couple of days later by two white people, apparently. So that was a local example of something related to racism happening. And as far as that clip where I think it was the guy up in Canada, I think it may have been that clip, and he was interviewing two people, and the guy said, you know, it's very difficult to prove racism. And it really reminded me of Neely Fuller, you know, when he was saying, he would say that in lectures and even on this program when he appeared, and many times when he was saying it's difficult. So, like, you know, that term, suspected racist, is used, so they can't necessarily, you know, go off of you making like an accusation. And even that term was used with something similar, I think, was allegation, and some strict codification was used when he was interviewing the white person that knew the lady that said the word nigger. And the guy was saying, well, you know, this is pretty much a mishap. And, you know, I don't basically see that as an act of racism. So for him to just completely and just go and just dismiss like that, and it just goes to show that he knows that he is in a position of power, and I can just say what I think constitutes is racism and what I don't. And, you know, I think also, like what I said before, he's probably doing the same things, and a lot of white people don't want to punish other whites for doing things that they pretty much do on a daily basis by default. And that's all I have for now, and I'll give it to the next person. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to the callers and the listeners on the line. This is Rob calling in from Milwaukee. Just a couple of observations. The interviewer, the price of a pound of flesh, I thought that the interviewer may have been practicing racism when he asked her, I believe the question was, what would you have done if you were in that situation? And I think she answered the question brilliantly. The clip on from Flint, Michigan, where the black family were getting terrorized by the suspected racist, and they tied her doorknob to something to where she couldn't get out, and she asked the question, what was next? And my mind immediately went to gas and fire. Sounds like a very dangerous situation, excuse me. The clip also where it talked about he asked the tacky question about what did they care about, and it stood out to me that even under the system of white supremacy, people that's classified as black was practicing humanity by caring where they were sold to and who they were sold to, so that they could be maybe closer to people that they were related to. And thanks for playing the clip on Dr. Welsing when she mentioned people from Syria coming up in here. That's the same thing that I mentioned to the black female as soon as I saw the clip on the news, the attempted black female in my survival unit. And thanks for taking the call for the sake of time. Need my line.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. I just wanted to say that I know all of us black people and non-white people are victims of racism or racial terrorism, and we don't really, a lot of us don't quite understand the problem, and we don't know any better. But I'm so sick of black people saying stuff like we're our own worst enemies, and if black people unify, we could overthrow white, white supremacy, I say white terrorism. We could overthrow this system. And, you know, I've talked to some people on Facebook about that, but I don't go on Facebook no more to talk about anything, because the groups I was in, it's supposed to be real conscious, but these people, they be saying that, and I'm like, what about right after chattel slavery when we had Wall Street and Rosewood and places like that? I said, we were unified, and we still cannot overthrow them. I had a cousin that said she had relatives, it was an all-black town up in Northern California, and they were doing really well, but the whites poisoned their drinking water. And black people keep saying, well, we're our own worst enemies, and I keep, you know, saying, no, we're not. We're white terrorism. Whites are our worst enemy, and they just don't seem to get it, you know, and it just makes me not even want to discuss things with, you know, a lot of black people like that, because, I mean, I almost wish I had a dollar for every time I heard a black person say that. I mean, I'd be rich. I mean, I don't understand. I could see a lot of the ones that are very naive about racism, but the ones that are conscious or whatever, I just can't believe that they're still saying things like that. And that's all I want to say. Thank you.
Are there other folks, anyone that we have missed totally? Anybody who dialed in with a hand up that we have not heard from at all, have commentary that they wanted to share?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus, and to the other callers. This is Sam from KC. I was doing something with my wife on Thursday, so I wasn't able to call in to the workplace racism this Thursday, but this week, I work in the construction field. I'm an electrician, and from what I observe, that field, people are a lot more vulgar with their language, especially the people classified as white, the males. The language, a lot of times, is just, it's so interesting. They're going over the delectable, because a lot of the language is a lot very homoerotic between the males. My observation from being in it for about 4 or 5 years. It's so interesting. Was it Thursday? I believe it was. And we were sitting there, end of the day, and I had my head down on my phone, and they were, a couple of my coworkers were talking back and forth, and I told one of my coworkers, he said, you know, you should suck my chocolate salty balls. And it's so interesting that I caught it right at that moment, and I just kind of looked up, and I looked at my other coworker, and he just kind of was like, it was so strange. And his response to him was like, well, it was like, well, I would, but, you know, you don't have, it was just so crazy. I don't know if it was a Wellesley moment or what it was, because the coworker who said it, he kind of looked too, and it was just his response back. It was just like, well, you know, it's just something I said to you. And so it was just the whole conversation was just so strange. But that, those type of conversations happen daily. What they would do to one another, you know, all these conversations and things of that nature. It's just, to me, it just makes a hunt for, it, to me, my observation, it shows me more of what's on their brain and the things that they really want to do. And it's just jokes surrounding that. It's so interesting. And the last thing I want to say is that I was coming out of the bank yesterday. And like I said, I'm an electrician, an apprentice, and I saw a non-white electrician working on the outside lighting of the bank I was exiting. And me and him had a really, it was so funny because I don't really know what type of conversations I'll have with another black person, especially when they're strangers in the society. But him, me and his conversation was very, I would say, very constructive. And just, it was so interesting, Gus, and the callers and the listeners, he ended up giving me workplace suggestions to deal with racism, white supremacy. And it was just, for me, I was very, very encouraged from that conversation that me and him had. And that's all I have to say.
Awesome. That's great. Meet another black person and can exchange tips on surviving the workplace. That's awesome. Anyone that we have not heard from at all? Anyone that we have not heard from at all have commentary? So we got everybody. There's nobody that we have missed who has a hand up. Okay, I will assume we got everyone. Other folks, if anybody had additional comments they wanted to get in, something else they wanted to add, or if anybody is listening who has not yet raised a hand and you think you have a comment you would like to share, you should go ahead and get your hand up. We have about a little less than 40 minutes left in the program.
Can I
guess we'll get the female caller first and then we'll get the other folks as well.
I was quick with it this time. It's really quick. I just wanted to let folks know, in case they were at all interested and maybe it fell off their radar, regarding the emotional emancipation circles and becoming a facilitator. They have their 2017. It's not complete, but they do have some of their places. Like, I think North Carolina is on there. Detroit just happened. I think there's one in, like, Mississippi. So if you were interested, you just need to miss it. You can check out their website in case you still wanted to get in. That's it. Thanks.
Awesome.
Have you heard?
Awesome. Yes, sir. We can hear you.
I just wanted to mention there was this week on BET, there was a new edition of autobiography that came on. And, like, one of your favorite suspected white supremacists, Michael Rappaport, starred in it. And it was interesting, his dynamic of the manager who screwed the group over a lot of ducats. it highlights totally how, you know, a lot of white managers do, these new artists and people entering the entertainment business. So it was a good show. If you haven't seen it, thanks to check it out. Again, like Dr. Francis Cress Wilson said, reading is more important than television. But that's something I think you would be interested in. I'll be on.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. We can hear you.
Okay. Hey, Gus. I just wanted to talk about the executive orders that Trump passed through. An observation. I'm one that's also very gleeful that Barack Obama is out of office. In my opinion, he put black people to sleep.
Metaphor.
So metaphor. Sorry. He unarmed black people.
Another metaphor.
Black people. Oh man, that's a metaphor too. All right. So, however, to move on. So it's funny how a lot of black people would come at me and say it was when his first term it was okay, he's going to do something for us. The second term, when the second term was over, it was, what can he do? His hands was tied. It was Congress. And in a matter of days, without having to reach across the aisle or beg Congress for anything, President Trump signed a number of executive orders. And, and just basically disproving that notion that, you know, Barack Obama just was this defenseless, helpless guy that Congress wouldn't work with. So that was just very interesting. And also, when Barack Obama pleaded with the black community to go out and vote to protect his legacy, and it's evident that his legacy was destroyed in a matter of days. Some of his key legislation, notable legislation, Obamacare and I think TPP, was attacked by Donald Trump's executive orders. So that was just interesting, and that was just an observation. Again, Barack Obama is also a victim of white supremacy, but I would also say that he's a participant, a willful participant, and he's definitely, from some of his speeches and notably the last speech, he's fully aware of the function of white supremacy. So I would say that he's a willing participant.
You said that before, so what should be done about that? I like to hit the fast forward button on that because I had to listen to that for 8 years. So should anything be done to him, about him, now that he's out of office?
Nothing.
Oh, okay.
He's off in the sunset.
Oh, okay. So that's another metaphor. Yeah. We can let all of that go then with President Obama. And one other thing, exactly what you just stated about those executive orders, white people pointed that out this week. White people that I suspect of being white supremacists pointed that out this week, that when President Obama attempted to sign executive orders, you had all manner of whites saying, wait a minute, you are not authorized, and who do you think you are? And you are our king. And there was tons of this when he went to sign executive orders. Donald Trump is in the office 1 week and begins signing executive orders, and you did not hear the same hue and cry and whites being angry and charges that he thinks he's a king and a ruler and what's going on and all this. Presidents are allowed to do that. Even some white people pointed out that difference, and some of them even said, seems like this could be racism. They didn't say white supremacy, but it seems like this could be racism in terms of how people are responding to a non-white president carrying out the presidency, a white president carrying out the presidency. Noted just this week as well. Other folks who had additional comments.
Have you heard? Can I be heard? Oh,
yes.
Go ahead. I'll go after you.
Thomas in New York.
Hey, Gus. Man, you sound a little hoarse tonight. Thomas Smith in New York. I caught the beginning clips, and then I kind of had to get on the travel to the plantation where I'm at now. So I just wanted to say President Obama did sign a lot of executive orders as the president. And as you did say, he was ridiculed for doing so. Just to note that only thing that Trump can do as the new president is take away an executive order of the old president. If something went through Congress and passed, there's nothing the president can do. That's the law. So I just think a lot of this stuff that he has passed through this week is just showing his level of dedication to being a racist white supremacist, as I expected. And I think that the way the media is positioning themselves as like this is some big surprise. I'm like, he said it the whole campaign trial. This is what he was going to do. So I don't know. And this is what a huge percentage of white people voted for. I don't know why they're trying to act like they're all surprised about it now. They were all for it, and they voted for it. As per the clips, the tooth extraction, the kid, oh man, I would be livid. I didn't know they had a program where they clean kids' teeth in school. I mean, I guess if this wasn't under the system of racism, white supremacy, that would be a great program, but I don't know if that would be something I would sign my kids up for. But just the fact that they sent him home with no supervision access. Didn't give him any pain medication to take home with him. Just shows, you know, just how negligent they are about black children, black people in general. And, you know, that one really touched the nerve because I have, you know, young children. Also, the school board, you know, the person who did the clip, was that the Young Turks, Gus?
Are you talking about the one where it was a white woman, she called a parent, the nigger parent, talking to the media? Is that the one you're talking about? That was Desmond Cole.
Yeah.
He's a black male in Canada.
Okay. Because he kept saying, I can't say the word. Then he spelled it. And then it's just like, well, if you could spell the whole word, you know, usually here they just say the N-word. But, I mean, he said N-I-G-G-E-R. I was like, well, just say it. And I was just like, so hoping those parents would say, yes, you called me a nigger. But, you know, of course, they use the N-word, our level of confusion, of course. But I think it's very important that any time that word is used, that if we ever have a microphone put in front of our face, that we say that word that was used, it just adds so much more, you know, yeah, she's being, we want her going because she called me a nigger. It sounds a lot better than, I want her going because she called me an N-word. And I'll meet my mom. Thank you, Gus.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I think Mr. Cole actually said legally they're not allowed to say that, so that's why he didn't actually say the word. If I'm not mistaken, I could be wrong, but I do think I remember him saying that they're not allowed to say it. Over public airwaves in Canada, or at least in that part of Canada anyway. But I also wanted to relate something. Actually, yesterday morning, I got in a text from my coworker. They shuffled the teams around on my job, and I'm sitting next to a black female that had like quite a few racial incidences that I've discussed on the program before. And she had texted like maybe a little after six in the morning, that she had to deal with a situation with her son where the bus driver snatched him up by his chest and, like, I guess yanked him onto the bus or something. And when she got to work, she told me that there was a black male from Trinidad that actually grabbed him up and said something to him like he was a Trini gangster or some nonsense like that. And the woman who runs the facility that runs the bus program that drives the kids around, she explained to me that this woman actually curses at the children. She verbally abuses them, she yells at them, and anything that they do basically that she disagrees with, she yells and she curses at them. So they tried to basically say her son was a problem and that he was creating all these issues and that he behaves in what they described as a gangster type of behavior. Now this business is run by black people, and she went to the school to defend her son, or she's going to, but she ended up having her husband go because he actually had to stay home from work since he had broken his finger recently at the job. So he went to the school to address the situation, and she's now looking for a different bus company to drive her children to school because there have been other incidences with other people's children. But this one was fairly acute because the guy, like, snatched him up by his chest. So she was actually afraid that her husband might get into an incident due to him being, you know, just agitated with the fact that these people physically assaulted his son. Thank goodness it worked out okay. But ultimately, she told me it was a white teacher who investigated what took place after they had said all these terrible things about her son. And she had said, well, why didn't you say something from whatever the first incident was if my son was misbehaving so we could address it? Why would you, you know, wait until this man violated my son in order for you to attempt to do anything about it? So this white teacher actually came down to investigate what was happening because she had heard about what was happening. He was her student. He's 12 years old. And it was her who came in and said, that's one of her best students. You know, how you know, I don't understand why something like this would take place and what they're saying doesn't make sense. And she said that things started to roll as far as them getting a better response from the people in authority once the white teacher got involved and spoke up for her son's reputation. I met her son before. He's a very well-behaved student. She's a well-behaved child, and said, you know, of course he's 12, so he has just he's trying to push his boundaries at the age of 12, like 12-year-olds do. But outside of just the normal incidences of just him acting like a 12-year-old, he's not a violent child. He's a highly intelligent student. So the white teacher basically helped to push the situation forward. She said, depending on what's taking place, there might be a lawsuit involved. She's not sure. She doesn't know if she really wants to take it that far. She said she really would just like to remove him from that situation and put him on another bus. So this kind of fell in line with some of the stuff we're playing in regards to the treatment of black children by the school system or related to the school system. So I wanted to relay that to everyone. Thank you very much, and I'll meet my line.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to quickly say, for anyone who is interested in knowing more about King Leopold and the atrocities he committed, I recommend the publication King Leopold's Ghost. Just be aware, it was written by a white man, but I got it off Amazon for, I think, a penny several years ago. Also, it was nice to hear from the female who spoke before MA. I always enjoy listening to the commentary from the individuals, you know, who has been participating in the program for a while. Thank you.
For sure. Clarence Lussain, he's a professor at American University in D.C., or actually, he's not at American University anymore. He used to be at American University. He has relocated, but he's written a number of great books that deal with racism. He was on the program back in 2010, and we talked briefly because we talked about two of his books. We talked about Pipe Dream Blues, which is about racism and what they call the drug war, and then we talked about Hitler's Black Victims, which deals with black people from the continent and even black U.S. soldiers who were terrorized during World War II. But he also talks about King Leopold's Ghost, the book that was written by a white man, and pointing out some of the racism, white supremacy in the text and how the white author constructed that book. So if you go back to hear Clarence Lussain, 2010, he that did take up a brief bit of the discussion there as well on King Leopold's Ghost and the atrocities in the Congo.
Awesome. Hey, Gus, there's another good book that deals with the Congo, too. It's called Dancing in the Glory of Monsters, The Collapse of the Congo, The Great War of Africa by Jason K. Stearns. That's another one as well. I believe also written by a racist suspect as well, but it also deals with the war in the Congo, too, and King Leopold. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I was just thinking, would I be correct or incorrect of the potential carnage that can take place over the oil pipe issue out west? As I think everybody knows, when Mr. Obama was in office, there was a confrontation, but I think with his, in some way, authorization, it was diffused and I guess put off. But as soon as Mr. Trump came into office, he said that he's going to put the pipeline in that same area. So just in my mind, I could just visualize potential carnage with this potential standoff that will be taking place over it. And I just wondered if anybody thinks about it in the same way or similar way or not at all.
I agree with you. Absolutely. I've been watching that, too. That's one of the first things he did. Was I think he signed an executive order to move ahead with the pipelines, and everything is reassembling as far as the protests, and I can definitely see it getting violent because he's the law and order president, and I believe it's in California or some of the states in the West where now they're saying in this, I forget the state, but if you resist arrest, that's considered a hate crime. I think it might be Louisiana or something like that, but they're saying that they this is what they're moving towards, and I can see that going nationwide. So definitely I agree with you on that. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, I agree also.
It was a big deal in Louisiana. That's where I'm from. It was in The Advocate when they talked about the pipeline bringing more jobs back down here. And, you know, this state is in a deficit of at least $700 million, and plus the flood that occurred last year. They talked about it being a big deal about the pipeline bringing more jobs and things down here, but I assume that they just wanted, you know, more fighters just to honor President Barack Obama's legacy. But, you know, we just have to pay attention to see how that plays out down here.
The one thing with that, I definitely think there's potential for a lot of violence against people that against potentially non-white people. Also, at least from my observations, it seemed like there were a significant number of individuals that could be classified as white who were participating or paying attention to those protests, the ones that were happening up in the Dakota area. My BFF, Amy Goodman, was out there frolicking, and I think she even got arrested out there doing news coverage. I could see that being another event. Not that it's definitely unjust what they're doing and harmful to non-white people. However, I could also see that being another event for racial theater, much like the protest this past weekend, where it gives opportunity for young whites to go out and protest and roll around and get arrested and down with the man, down with the system. I didn't vote for that sort of thing. And to just spread confusion to make it seem like, oh, man, there are a lot of these young white people. They are with it. We are going to get our interracial social justice movement on. I could see that happening big time, just like Kent State in the 70s and things that were happening 50 years ago during the Civil Rights Movement.
Bernie Sanders.
I agree completely wrong with that assessment. And just to add a little more context to his executive order, I was just watching a clip, might have been on YouTube, and it was a young Donald Trump, and he was petitioning having a Native Americans opening up casinos to compete with his. And, you know, he was there complaining about how they, you know, have to pay taxes and how they're giving this certain land. And, you know, he made such racist comments, like, you know, I mean, whatever happened to them happened so long ago that the head of the board at this meeting had said, you know, this is some of the most, you know, he said, racist comments I've ever heard in my life, you know, and I didn't expect that, you know, from you coming, you know, here before this board. And Trump's response was sort of like, hey, I mean, you know, I feel how I feel. And I just think that he's had it out for them for some time, probably thinking that they messed up a lot of his business in Atlantic City. And, you know, just his mindset seems to be tick for tack. And I can see him, I pretty much foresaw this coming. I didn't think it was going to happen so fast, though.
Oh, I also wanted to add, just going back to the Dakota Pipeline situation, I don't know if maybe somebody already spoke about this or not, but also on the news, they were talking about the law, or I think it was the North Dakota or South Dakota representative trying to put into law in that state, if you unintentionally, and they had unintentionally in quotes, run over protesters, you wouldn't, there would basically be no reprimandment. And also, if just going back to what someone else said about, not so much about the Blue Lives Matter, because I have actually read about that law about, you know, it being a hate crime against police if you do anything to them. And I also thought, well, with four white men killing law enforcement officers than anyone else, I just find it curious to see if anyone's actually going to maybe study if they actually apply those extra punishments, or I don't really know the name for it, going along with that law, if they're going to apply those to the white men who also harm law police officers. And also, they were talking about with the protesters in Dakota, or in one of the Dakotas, if they do disrupt the normal flow or traffic or disturb the peace,
they could actually be charged the salary for having the police out there to disperse them. So it was definitely very weird, and it seems like it's definitely, as everyone else is saying, it's definitely falling in line to what Trump is trying to do to the country as far as law and order. Thank you.
Gus, I got a question. They was talking about King Leopold's ghost. I'm not sure. Was Rwanda, did Belgium have any connection with Rwanda? If I'm not mistaken, was Rwanda also colonized by Belgium?
No.
So Rwanda was?
I believe that's French. I could be wrong. It's not Belgium. They only own the Congo. Belgium is small, like it's the same much amount of land as Hawaii has. It's real small, so they were given that one huge chunk of land, the Congo, so on the other side from Rwanda. I believe Rwanda is French. I know Roz might know, but I'm pretty sure it's French. I just wanted to say, as far as that pipeline, totally different set of laws for these protesters as opposed to Cliven Bundy and his gang. Totally different set of laws.
Absolutely. I think Rwanda is French. The French whites from France did the terrorizing in that area predominantly.
No, I just looked it up. It was Belgium.
Oh, okay. Good to know. Good to know.
Right. It was Belgium.
Well, I'm just happy to see that people are talking about King Leopold II. Hitler. He should be synonymous with Hitler. That's my goal for 2017. Every nine white person I talk to, I want to bring King Leopold II up.
And yes, it is. Too. It does sound potentially that... That it would be some white people that would be sacrificed in that pipeline issue, from what I'm gathering from listening to others, that could be possible. It seemed as though, from what I'm hearing also, is that through the people activity of laws, they're laying down legislation to basically confirm it with the rest of the world of white people that are in power who are practicing racism, white supremacy. And if there is some sort of resistance, that by the time that they go about the means of physically going about the business of quote unquote laying down the pipes, that it'll be okay, so to speak. My understanding of it, that's what gangsters do, which are the white people who practice racism. Sometimes they get squabbles with another, and in turn, one group physically confronts and eliminate a certain level of that group. And this is not the first time it's something similar has happened. It's not the first time. There have been some white people who have been sacrificed in that particular way.
That was Gantz's dude.
I just wanted to add Cecil Rhodes to the list that should be up there with Hitler too.
Awesome, him too.
Yes, yeah. That in the King Leopold's ghost, it speaks about Cecil Rhodes. He's done a lot of damage in Southern Africa, Central and Southern Africa.
He was a known pedophile too. He used to rape young black boys, and from what I understand, he didn't like to rape the same child twice, so he would toss them off a cliff after using them sexually. He was a real sick dude. So super thick.
I have a question, Gus and Guess. I was out with a young lady last night, and she's from Liberia. So So we had a conversation about Africa. She doesn't believe that Africa is still being controlled by European powers, and it's kind of hard to bring a person up to speed that really doesn't have a vast history or just limited history on colonization of Africa. So how would you entertain or educate somebody in that kind of conversation? To basically try to explain the influence of Western powers in Africa.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Me personally, I would, at this point, I would not. I think more energy should be put towards finding other victims that have a greater understanding of racism, white supremacy, to engage in these sort of conversations with, because at this point, I think that there is so much evidence around that there is a system of white supremacy in place and so much resources in place that I think that victims will come to the realization on their own, and that it's usually a wasted effort to try to bring somebody to a greater level of understanding of this system. I think it's better that you wait till they ask you about this system to start educating them about what the situation is. I think that's something that Neely Fuller himself suggests, is that conversations in this matter be prompted by a victim, and then you use that opportunity to educate. But to try to bring somebody to a greater level of understanding, to see something that is plainly in front of them, I think that that's something that at this point, oh man, that's I don't know. Like trying to force I didn't want to use a metaphor. I'll just mute my line at this point.
I think the last caller was absolutely correct, and to do so otherwise, you are inviting argument. The person probably already has heard what you would be saying to them already, and they don't want to hear it from you. And he was absolutely correct. And irregardless of Mr. Fuller, it's just logical. It's just a logical, you can understand it without even knowing Mr. Fuller, that anything else would invite argument, which is something that non-white people should not do. It's a bad history of that type of discourse amongst non-white victims of racist white supremacy. And I have not witnessed anything constructive that comes out of it. Thank you.
I definitely concur. But the reason I mentioned that King Leopold II is somebody is more, you know, it's not like it's not common. Not too many people know about that. And for us as non-whites to know about people like Hitler, is that the Jewish people, they definitely made Hitler's name rank with the atrocities of World War II. So do we not inform people about people who are not commonly known throughout history? Or do we just let them go on without knowing this information? I learned this information in college. I mean, it's not like it's being taught to all non-whites. So what do we do with information like that? Do we just sit on that information and not spread it, or do we just, you know, remain codified and just let that information just sit?
I think that the information has been spread. I think that you know about this information. I think that the fact that you know about is evidence that other victims know this information. I think that, however, the situation that was described earlier where a victim is arguing that, in essence, that there is no system of white supremacy that operates worldwide. I think that if you don't acknowledge that at all, I think that that's a poor starting place to having a greater conversation about figures like King Leopold II. And I think that if you are trying to force somebody to come to this information, it's just going to it's not going to be received very well, and it's not going to be received in a constructive manner. So again, if somebody is not receptive to, if a victim is not receptive to this information, if they are in essence saying that they are not a victim, trying to convince them that they are is typically a vain pursuit.
Yeah, I understand what
you're
saying.
I think one of the things,
but basically,
Billy, hello?
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah.
Really quick, I know you all are having a conversation, but just really quick, a female's perspective, just one. I think videos and other people saying things is very constructive when another non-white person is engaging you or, say, me in conversation or dialogue about racism, white supremacy, that all the other callers were correct, that a lot of times they don't want to hear it coming from the person that they're talking to. They're viewing that person more as unilateral, and if you come off as though you know something they don't know, a lot of times we can have a block and not want to receive the information. However, you already have resources that you can put her onto. So if you know documentaries or you know YouTube videos or anything like that, sometimes you could just randomly send it. Not send it or give it to her when you all are actually talking about it, but you can just be like, oh, I found this, and put it in an email or send it in a text message, and then she can view it in her own way on her own time and not feel like she's being lectured to. That would be my suggestion. I mean, you can't change someone's mind frame, but I think that we do all, if you have information, then we have, like, I think it's Black self-respect to share to the best of our ability.
Yeah.
If people refuse it, they refuse it. But we can still be creative in how we put them on. Now, that's just to answer your question. But one other thing I just wanted to say before we end, because the call is going to end. When I was thinking about the teeth being extracted, teeth, you can gather genetic material. So it'd be very interesting, like, how we begin to talk to our children about letting any of these people touch their bodies, because you can genetic material, and I'm pretty sure that they didn't just throw the teeth away. And a lot of times when you get teeth extracted, they don't give them to you. They say for health reasons that they're not allowed to give you your own teeth. What happened to the little boy's teeth? Who has them, and who's extracting genetic material from his teeth? Thanks.
I wanted to say I agree with Emmy. I was going to suggest Hidden Colors is a great series that will help her understand. Specifically relating to the Congo, there's a movie called Lumumba, starring an African actor by the name of Eric Ebonet, which really deals with the Congo specifically. That is phenomenal. I was going to put that out there, but definitely I think that all of what was just previously stated is correct. You don't want to get into an argument, but you can definitely take creative ways to try and bring information to people. And usually something like a documentary or something where it's explaining from a historical perspective from ancient to modern times would be helpful. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
Yeah, and basically, I'm just arguing about the dissemination of information. And, I mean, we have information that just pass it on and keep it going. And documentaries are great, a great way to get those through, get the message through.
Thanks. I agree with all you guys. That's I'll definitely keep that in mind. It just gets kind of lonely in your journey of learning about racism, white supremacy, and you're surrounded by people who A, care, or B, doesn't think it exists. So when it comes to talking about this information, other than listening to the cows and other people that's that's aware of racism, white supremacy. You feel isolated. And I just have one more question before this goes off. And I guess this would be a question for workplace racism. I was at work, and a salesperson came by, lifted his pants up, and showed his socks with Donald Trump. I don't know if I was codified. I just smiled and just, okay, and just continued with my work. I feel that this particular co-worker, one day he's going to try and engage me about my thoughts on Donald Trump. So I dread that day. So what does you guys suggest I do to even avoid this particular coworker?
We have talked about this on workplace racism before, and that's going to be number one that we bring up on Friday. The quick one that I can give in the limited amount of time that we had that I think works wonderfully, and I think even some of our participants right now can attest to this, having tried it on the job with race soldiers, and it worked beautifully. I don't discuss politics on the job. What? Nothing else need be said. And if they persist, come on, kid, this is just me. We're old buddies. We've been working together for 5 years. What do you think about president? Come on. I don't discuss politics on the job. All you need to do is say that one sentence and keep on. And if they persist, if this happens, if you're away from your work area, well, good bumping into you. We'll talk at lunch. Good luck on that project, and I'll see you later today. And you just go on about your business. If they're at your desk, well, I will talk to you a little bit later. I'm going to run to the restroom really quick, and I'll talk to you later. And you just get up and move. When you get back to your desk, if they're still there, hey, great talking to you, but I got a lot of work to get done. I don't want to get behind. I have to talk to you later, and you just go about your work. You don't even start the conversation, and as I stated, I think some of the people that are on right now have suggested and used that method, and it worked flawlessly every time. You just have to be codified to make sure that all you say is, I don't talk about politics on the job. With that, and we'll bring that up again Thursday if folks have other suggestions for how to deal with that sort of thing now that Trump is in the White House, and if you might be asked that sort of question to comment on what he's doing or what you think about him, how you want to deal with that in the workplace. But with that, that will wrap up the compensatory call-in for this evening. If you have questions, guest suggestions, problems, if you can't find something in the archives, if you're looking for the Turner Diaries and you can't find it, I think 1984 was mentioned. That is also in the archives. We did that in the book study session as well. I think in close proximity, if my memory is accurate, we did the Turner Diaries, President Obama, Dreams from My Father, and then 1984. I think that's the exact order that we did those books. But at any rate, feel free to drop an email if you have a question or what have you, untiljustice@gmail.com, untiljustice@gmail.com. We'll be here on Monday, normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We have an author. He writes about racism, white supremacy in Brazil. I think some of our listeners are familiar with his content. Should be great to hear global system of racism, white supremacy, to hear about the operations in the, I guess that would be South American continent, since we normally are focused on things that are happening here in the States or elsewhere, to focus on things happening south of the equator for Monday evening. Looking forward to it. I'll post some of his different articles and things that he's written about so you can kind of do a little homework in advance of his visit Monday evening. With that, thanks again for everyone tuning in. Remain safe, as we say consistently. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. I've seen no evidence that us being intoxicated, whether it's tobacco, alcohol, cannabis, any other narcotics that whites create, none of that has helped us solve the problem. Racist man, racist woman, racist child. I think we should work to make sure that we are operating at maximum efficiency, being able to think so that we can come up with concepts, solutions to permanently neutralize the global white minority. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.